It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech. We have a big show for you. Patrick Beja joins us from FrenchSpin.com. Amy Webb, futurist Michael Nunez from Mashable. We'll talk about ordering the iPhone 10. And what really, I think, the most interesting conversation throughout, the thread throughout the whole conversation is what these new products from Apple and Amazon and Facebook and Google tell us about their real interests, their real data interests. It's next on TWiT.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 638, recorded Sunday, October 29th, 2017. The Frightful Five on the SplinterNet. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Scott eVest, a full line of functional clothing that features well-designed pockets so you can carry all of life's gadgets without carrying a bag. For a limited time, go to scottevest.com/twit and get an extra 25% off your order. And by Jamf Now, Apple management software for Mac, iPad, and iPhone devices. Visit Jamf, JAMF.com/twit to create your free Jamf Now account and manage your first three devices absolutely free. And by Carbonite, keep your business safe this year. Protect your business from ransomware and hacker attacks with automatic data protection solutions from Carbonite. Try it free at Carbonite.com. Use the offer code TWIT to get two free bonus months if you decide to buy. And by Blue Apron. Now you can expand your wine palette with Blue Apron's wine boxes. They're not a box of wine. They're bottles of wine that come in a box. So $25 off your first box by going to blueapron.com/twitwine. It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech, the show where we cover the week's tech news. We're going to have a lot of fun this week. Joining us from Mashable, Michael Nunez is here. Great to see you, Michael.
Great to see you as well.
I'm guessing by the windows and the backdrop, you are somewhere in the Northeast, perhaps New York City.
You nailed it. Yeah, you've caught me in my apartment in Brooklyn.
Brooklyn. In fact, I was going to say Brooklyn. I should have narrowed it down.
Great. Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, same difference. But yeah, I'm glad to be here.
Those are definitely Brooklyn bricks. I could tell. Actually, you know, you're in the East Coast because this doesn't happen in California when you have those old-fashioned sash windows, you know, with the counterweights, and there's lots of layers of paint. That's to me, that's East Coast. I grew up in Rhode Island. I know that look. It's great. Wonderful to have you, Michael. Also with us, Amy Webb. She is a futurist. She is at the Future Today Institute and wrote a book. In fact, we met when I interviewed her about the signals are talking on triangulation. And we just love having Amy on. Very smart, but also with a particular angle. First of all, she knows Japan very well. And I think uses her experiences there and elsewhere to kind of think about what's going on in the future. And that's certainly something we like to talk about. Welcome, Amy.
Thanks for having me back.
Nice to have you. And our Frenchman, our favorite Frenchman, who we haven't had on in so long that he's now at a new job in a new country. Patrick Beja is here. FrenchSpin.com. He does the Phileas Club, his English language podcast, and Le Rendezvous Tech, his French language podcast. He's a full-time podcaster, and he's now in Finland. He's followed his Swedish wife there.
Yeah, well, my Finnish Swedophone wife. Yeah, indeed.
I married a Finnish Swedophone. I like that. That's good.
So, and we're expecting a baby now. So
oh, congratulations.
Will that baby speak is a complete mystery even to us.
Because your native tongue, of course, is French. Her native tongue is Swedish, but you live in Finland where the native tongue is obviously Finnish. I think clearly all three.
I think that's the plan, but he will not learn Finnish at home. He will have to learn that in school.
Yeah, his friends, won't his friends mostly speak Finnish?
Well, it depends. There are many Swedish speakers in certain parts of the country. And so if you're in those parts, probably the friends are going to be speaking a lot of Swedish as well. So, yeah.
Okay, this is a pretty eclectic bunch, and I'm not sure how this is going to go, but how many of you were up early Friday morning? Would have been 3 a.m. for Amy and Michael, and I don't know what the hell time it would have been for you, Patrick, ordering an iPhone 10. Patrick, you were ordering an iPhone 10.
Yeah, it was 10 a.m. It was perfect.
Oh, forget it. Jeez.
It's midnight here now when we're doing the show, right. But to order an iPhone 10, it was great. Except, you know, I don't really need the phone, so I wasn't crushed, but I had to wait until like 10:08, so 8 minutes for it to finally refresh for me. And of course, by then it was like 5 weeks or six weeks of wait. So
I think that's, and Amy, you don't feel the need to get an iPhone 10
I don't. Maybe. I've long since given up on iOS. I am a happy Samsung Galaxy 8 user. Yeah.
Yeah. I love the Note 8. I have the Note 8, which I really like. Yeah. But I've ordered the Pixel XL, which we'll talk about, because what's interesting is with all of these newest phones, there are some challenges as these phone makers try to push the envelope. Most notably Samsung last year with the exploding Note 7, because they tried to put more battery in it and it didn't work out so well. But now Google's having some trouble with the Pixel. We'll talk about that in a little bit. Michael, do you care?
You know, I was lucky enough to have some coworkers that were willing to get up at that hour. So I myself didn't set my alarm. I slept all night, and we'll just kind of depend on some friends to check this device out.
Yeah, so. One of my coworkers, Megan Maroney, got hers. We'll be getting hers Friday, which is, of course, the official release date. Mine is 2 weeks after that. My wife. So I got up. I'm sitting in my home office. I've got a computer screen on the Apple Store, a computer screen on the T-Mobile Store. I've got an iPod, iPad on the iOS Store, and an iPhone on the iOS Store. I'm refreshing like a monkey. I'm refreshing, refreshing. It's midnight. It's 12:01. It's 12:02. Nothing. T-Mobile's still selling the upgrade to the iPhone 8, not to the iPhone 10. Refreshing. And when I finally got through, it wasn't on the Apple Store, which is the easiest way usually to get through. I got through on the Apple website, and you know, so I got 2 to 3 weeks delay. My wife stayed in bed. Her alarm went off at midnight. She sleepily got her iPhone, went right in the Apple Store and ordered it, and went back to sleep. I don't know what I did wrong. I tried, Apple. I tried hard.
Yeah, I felt the same way. I was, you know, looking at the great Steve in the sky, and I was thinking, tell me, what did I do wrong? 8 minutes. That's unnatural.
Isn't this very frustrating? I just find it's brilliant marketing. There is some debate, and it goes back and forth over whether these shortages, which seem to happen every year, are contrived for marketing purposes. I feel like every company, Nintendo with the Switch, will make as many as they possibly can, because every phone you don't sell day one is potentially a phone you'll never sell, right?
No, I agree. I think it's a common myth, unless you're in luxury, like real luxury, you know.
Well, there's nothing more luxurious than a $1,149 iPhone X.
Well, that's surprisingly luxury. You know, there are things like bags that cost three, four times
more. Yeah.
In those cases, you know, Louis Vuitton bag or something like that, I think in those cases, scarcity is manufactured. I don't think it's the case for the tech products that we enjoy. And I think that those are completely, you know, they're myths.
And it especially happens, as with the Switch or the 10, or with these new Pixel 2s, when you've got a new product, not a refresh of the old product like the iPhone 8, but a totally new product.
Yeah and it's not easy, to evaluate. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Amy.
Oh, I was just going to say, I don't know that that's entirely true. Because it's not just getting the hardware out the door. It's, the entire process and the whole funnel has to scale, right? So given the problems that we've seen with some recent products across everybody's different brands, you know, maybe people are taking a little bit more of a measured approach. I'm a cynic and, you know, part of me thinks that, holding off and manufacturing scarcity in order to increase everybody's thirst and desire for these products, which we have less and less attention for because there's just more competition in the marketplace, seems like a viable reason to make it so difficult to purchase a phone. But on the other hand, look at what happened with some of the most recent launches. Samsung's previous phone had problems, and You know, if you've suddenly got all of these people using a new phone with face recognition that may or may not work exactly as promised, you know, and the Pixel 2 having potentially some screen issues, I mean, there may be reasons to hold out on the number of products that get released at one time.
I don't think if Apple makes, you know, 3 million phones and some of them and they end up not working as advertised, it's not going to be a bigger issue than a smaller issue than if they make 15. The difference is going to be they're going to have, you know, X million less in the bank because they didn't sell as many. I mean, For the Switch, I can guarantee you it's also kind of scarce, but that is because of the success of the console, which is somewhat unexpected.
Unexpected, yeah. But everybody knows how many iPhones Apple. I mean, Apple would make exactly 20 million iPhones if it could.
Yeah, I think whether it's manufactured or not, it's definitely made me more interested in these products. So, the SNES Classic is a prime example. It's a device that I really don't want. There are better emulators out there. There are better versions or better ways to play Super Nintendo games. As a collector's item, I guess it's kind of neat, but for the most part, it's like a product that I would never want. The scarcity has made me so intrigued by that. It makes me really want to play the lost Star Fox game that's featured on there. And then also with the iPhone 10, you know, again, it's something that I don't need at all. You know, I already own an iPhone 7. It works just fine. But the fact that people are clamoring for this device, that there's so much intrigue around the $1,000 phone and that it's already sold out and that delays might spill into next year, I think that that makes me really interested in playing with the device or potentially owning it.
Well, but you're also in the press, so you measure that interest as well as and assume that that's going to carry over to Mashable, right? So I certainly consider this. If something is, you know, for instance, I love the Essential phone, Andy Rubin's little phone, and now it's $500. In fact, if you can get somebody with a friends and family, it's $299. If you know somebody was stupid enough like me to buy it at full price, you can get it to $299. It's a great phone, but they sold 5,000. Yeah. So why would we even cover it? There's nobody wants it.
I mean, coverage-wise,
and they have some issues to work out. You know, it's not a perfect phone. There are some camera issues, I think. And
they're not. That's a funny thing. They fixed the camera. They pushed out three updates. Okay. There is in no respect is it an inadequate phone. It's for $500 with a Snapdragon 835, a full bleed screen in a tiny form factor, titanium and ceramic. It is in many respects a flagship phone for $500, but it won't get any coverage because everybody's already decided.
Yeah. Well, it's essentially between just a couple of brands, but I think that Essential also has the problem of only being available on Sprint, at least in terms of the carriers that sell it. You might be able to buy it.
I bought it unlocked. But you know, you're right. There's other issues as well. My point being, editorially, you're not likely to spend any ink, if you used ink, covering it because, well, nobody cares anymore. It's over.
And yeah, it just seems that. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say so. Why is everybody clamoring for this phone?
The iPhone 10.
Yeah, I mean, what's the real? Why are all three of you excited about it?
That's a really interesting question. How else do we propel the consumer economy? That's why.
Let's answer the question specifically. Who is actually excited about the iPhone 10? I'm not. I'm not super excited. I'm going to get it, but it's not
Is it obligation? Like, what was the reason that you purchased it then?
I have a 6S currently, and I figured, you know, it's for work.
Did you buy an 8?
New features, and no, I didn't. I didn't. So,
okay. So by the way, that's what looks like, and this is, you know, nobody, Apple's not speaking, but that's what it looks like anecdotally happened, which is that Apple put out the 8, and then a month later, the 10, announcing them at the same time. And as one almost would predict, the 8 didn't really sell that well. People waited for the 10. To answer your question, I'm like Patrick, probably because we're tech journalists, we have to do this. But so I'm not sure I would characterize myself as excited, but the world is excited, and they're excited because it's the latest iPhone. It's the top of the line iPhone. And for the first time, Apple's done some interesting things, like get rid of the fingerprint reader, like a full bleed screen that is OLED, which Apple's never done before. So there are some actually unusual and new features in it. I wasn't excited about the iPhone 8, which is, as far as I could tell, a duplicate of the 7 with a faster processor and a few bells and whistles.
I'm just wondering if we've habituated ourselves to like in a Pavlovian way,
yes.
Almost, right? Like
Ding.
iPhone,
the
like
new
Apple
iPhone's here, the new iPhone.
Right? Because on the face of it, the features that are part of this of the 10. Aren't really that groundbreaking, aside for maybe the facial recognition. And I'm kind of surprised that everybody is so excited about facial recognition without stopping to ask questions like, okay, well, who owns your face, right? Like, does Apple own your face from here on out? You know, where does the data go? How is it being used? I'm having a hard time reconciling, unless it's just like it's like out of habit now. We're just excited because this is the latest announcement. You know,
I think that's where the intrigue comes from, right? It's like there are a lot of pieces of technology in the iPhone 10 that no one asked for, but they're being included, and it's about whether this is a fundamental change to the way that we use our phones, to the way that we pay for things on our phones. You know, I think that's where the interest and the intrigue lies. It's not necessarily will this phone sell as well as the last one. I think it's if you look at like just even Google search terms over the past 10 years, you know, the iPhone continues to get more and more popular, even just based on search. And I think it's probably one of the most easily identifiable products in the world. And so, yeah, as a journalist, it's such an obvious story of intrigue because not only is it something that makes a lot of money, it's something that is radically different for the first time in many years. And
you and I have a different definition of radical.
Yeah, I would disagree with that characterization.
No, I want to defend Michael. That's kind of what I was saying at the very beginning, which is we've reached peak phone. We clearly reached peak phone a couple of years ago. So now radically different is things like, you know, OLED screen. Or wireless charging, which for Apple is radically different.
No home button. Facial recognition. Yeah. I mean, those are two.
But when that's a measure of how kind of mature this, I think, isn't it, Michael, a measure of how mature the technology is that these differences now become radical differences. I mean, the iPhone 7 was radically different than the BlackBerry. It succeeded in my pocket.
Yeah, this isn't a technological. It's not a qualification of like the technological breakthrough. It's just this phone will operate much differently than the phone that you currently use. So every time you look at your phone right now, you're using a thumbprint scanner most likely to unlock your phone. In the case of the iPhone 10, that will fundamentally change because it will open automatically. And there are other elements like that I think will actually change the way that people are using their phones on a day-to-day basis. So, like, to me, that's what I'm that's one of the most interesting pieces of the iPhone 10. It's how deeply ingrained are some of these habits and how quickly will we change them and adopt new ones? And, you know, are there privacy concerns about the way that we begin to use our phones? You know, we're trying to make it a little bit more seamless and make operations a little bit faster. But in the process, I think there are certainly privacy concerns that are raised
Speaking of the Google interest, I've gone to Google Trends and I search for iPhone. And this is over a 5-year trend, and there are peaks every fall, September. There's a peak. Although the biggest peak was oddly 2 years ago. Or 3 years ago, September 2014. That would have been the iPhone six, which was the first big iPhone, and I think that's probably the last time you could say that the iPhone was, you know, a significant change. The peak this year is not significantly higher than the peak last year, and there is a secondary peak, which is happening right now, of course, as people try to figure out whether they should buy the iPhone 10.
Just for some perspective.
I will say, go ahead, Amy, go ahead.
Just for some perspective. So the facial recognition technology that we are excited about here in the United States has been in widespread use in China now for a while.
So Microsoft put it in the Kinect, which they just killed.
I mean, this is
three years ago. It's the Prime Sense technology from Israel that Apple bought.
Right. Yes. So, and there's, you know, lots of different, China is so far ahead of us in a lot of ways. You know, using your face to pay, using your face for authentication, for all these, you know, all different sorts of things. But China has a very different attitude legally and culturally towards personal data than we do in the United States. So that's, you know, as we are sort of, it may feel as though we are embarking upon this brand new journey with Apple and for the first time discovering what it's like to do all of this with our faces. You know, in reality, we're pretty far behind Korea and Japan. Right. And China to begin with. The other thing that I would mention to Leo's excellent point about reaching peak phone, all of the modeling that I've done and I, you know, with data, would indicate that this is the beginning of the end of smartphones. So
what's next?
Devices, so a combination of wearables that are on our faces and are on our hands. So glasses or a headset that you wear, except it points to your eye rather than comes near your mouth, and a ring or wristband that goes along with it. It's very likely, based on my modeling, that in the year 2027, we will be at the beginning of AR. So all of the functionality that, for the most part, that we've got with our phones, the screens that we hold will become the screens that we wear. So it's lovely and wonderful that iPhone is releasing the 10, and I hope everybody really enjoys it. but we are going to see fewer and fewer true innovations on the phone front, because the real news is that every company, Google, Facebook, Apple, they're pouring huge amounts of resources into AR and wearable AR. So,
and Apple is, I'm sure, doing that as well.
Yeah.
Although, you know, it's one thing to say, well, the phone is going to go away, but it's still here today. So Apple, I mean, this is their sort of big money. You can also probably fairly say that while Apple's growth over the last 10 years is entirely powered by the iPhone, that Apple can't expect that to continue forever. So Apple's got to be thinking about what's next. But meanwhile, and this is the innovator's dilemma, they need to mine this gold mine as deep as they can until they run out of, until that seam runs out of gold, while opening new seams in other areas.
That's right. So it's like a 10-year transition.
Yeah, they're working on AR.
Yeah, we've seen AR kit, which was very surprising in how efficiently it worked.
Yeah, but it's dopey. Have you played with it? Well, you don't have an iPhone 8.
It works on the 6S as well.
Yeah.
But that's today. So, but yes, all of this stuff is janky today, but that's not the point. The point is all of the investment and the capital, like the capital investment and the work and the people who are being hired. This is the beginning of the end of smartphones.
What's the time frame, do you think? 5 years?
My models are 10 years.
So you're looking in the distant future.
I mean, well, that's not my distant future, but yes.
Well, it's funny because 10 years isn't long in humans, but it's a long time in technology.
Well, you know, 10 years from now, the iPhone 10 will be the flip phone of 2027, right? Yeah. Right? So there will be some people that still have smartphones, which by today's measure are very sophisticated machines, but that'll be a smaller group of people since we will have moved on to devices.
So the real question for Apple is, are they going to be the BlackBerry?
That's a good question.
10 years ago.
No, see, but I think that's why that's a slight mischaracterization. It's because a lot of the technology that's used in the iPhone will be used in headsets. So something like a depth sensor, which is what enables Face ID, something like that, it's easy to imagine it in a headset like HoloLens or any augmented reality headset. But to me, the reason why it's important to follow the technological side of this is because the same processors and accessories that are included in a mobile phone in the iPhone could be used for this next generation of stuff that you're talking about. I think it's probably farther away than 10 years, just given the rate of innovation over the past 5 years that I've seen. But so I'm a little bit more skeptical than you are that this will be adopted as quickly as you're saying. But regardless, the technology that's being used to sort of push a lot of that forward is mobile technology. It's all of the stuff that's being used in the iPhone.
Right. I'm not saying one is in exchange of the other. What I'm saying is, I would expect to see fewer and fewer major innovations on mobile devices because the majority of time, effort, resources, and everything else is being placed into what comes several years from now.
Right.
So it's fine. You know, obviously pay attention to the devices as they're being launched, but all of the data and modeling that, you know, that I've got indicates pretty strongly that this is the beginning of the end, which is fine.
Although, yeah, of course, this is the nature of things. In fact, you hope technology moves along. Otherwise, it'd get pretty dull around here. But what's interesting, what I think Apple and Google, too, to a certain degree, are doing that's interesting is they are developing these next generation technologies, not merely in parallel with their existing technologies, but kind of in, for instance, this, as you pointed out, Michael, this iPhone X array of sensors in the notch here, which is basically a Kinect, is clearly, in fact, the way they're using it is the most trivial way possible. They're using it for Face ID. It's not even being used for augmented reality. If it were, it would be on the other side of the phone. But you can imagine that the data that they get, the information they get, the skills they learn. For instance, one of the problems with getting this out is this Romeo and Juliet sensor pair. They're having a hard time getting those out in quantity, apparently, according to rumors from the supply chain. But that's the kinds of problems Apple's solving now so that down the road. AirPods, same thing, or Google with the Google Buds, same thing. They're developing, and first of all, they're getting the consumer market ready for the idea of wearables in your ear or the Apple Watch, which is really, until recently, merely a glorified pedometer, getting used to the idea of you wearing phone technology. And then using the data that they gain and the skills they gain to further this, right, Amy? So that's they're not completely
that's
parallel
right.
tracks. And so
right.
one of the reasons, then, to answer your original question, why we might be excited about an iPhone 10 is this is a first look at some of these, particularly the Face ID technology, which is being used in an admittedly trivial way, but will be the precursor for something much more important.
So let's I would love to drill down on that. Because I'm so curious to know, given what I've seen and how face recognition technology, and not just face, but object recognition and biometric and bioinformatic recognition is being used elsewhere, I'm really curious to know how the three of you plan to use face recognition and if you're concerned at all.
Nah.
Okay.
The biometrics is interesting. I'll let you talk in a second. I just want to say one thing about biometrics. Unlike other forms of authentication, it's unchangeable. Your iris pattern, your fingerprint, your face pattern are kind of permanent. And
so let me blow your mind. Yeah, you're right. Your face is hard to change unless you do it intentionally.
With surgery, yeah.
That's right. But there's a way, a lot of the foundation of artificial intelligence, which underpins a lot of this technology, has been about teaching machines incorrect and correct. And part of the way that we teach them correct from incorrect is introducing adversarial information. So intentionally introducing one teeny tiny thing that's wrong, like a pixel. But one thing that we've discovered is that your face may be malleable. However, we could add a pixel through a line of malicious code to your face, which effectively then hacks your face. This is why I was asking, owns your face?
Like locks right? you out or with
That's
the
right. So and on the one hand, it seems like bioinformatics and bioinformation is much better than two-factor, right, or passwords or anything else because it's hard to take your face off and do something else with it unless you're in a sci-fi film. But what I'm trying to say is that there are plenty of ways using an algorithm and something simple like a pixel out of place that could lock you out of all of your devices or do all kinds of
that's interesting.
Nefarious things. Yeah. So,
I hadn't
so,
thought of it that way. I thought of
yeah.
usually you
so
think of authentication being somebody trying to impersonate you.
Right. And there are all kinds of easy ways.
Well, it introduces new risks, but it also eliminates a lot of other risks. So, I mean, I think in the spectrum of being secure versus unsecure, it might not be the best choice. Maybe a numeric, you know, an alphanumeric PIN is still the safest. But it's, I think that like a lot of people are going to use it just because it's going to be really easy.
People don't use PINs because it's too hard. So, and that's why I thought Touch ID and that was an innovation because it was so fast and easy, and it did encourage people to secure their devices. Most people did not secure their devices before Touch ID. They didn't want to do a PIN. It was too much of a pain in the butt.
And I think if people are comfortable with Touch ID and with giving their information, you know, whether or not Apple or others are secure, people are comfortable giving their fingerprint information to those companies. I'm not sure they're going to be, I mean, there's going to be a little bit more resistance for faces, but not so much that it's going to get the technology to tank. But that being said, I do think, I mean, we have reached a peak phone, and all of you have said this in different ways, but the technologies that we're seeing now are not as exciting as they were 5 years ago in the phone space. And I think we're all sort of discounting another reason why we are quote unquote excited about the iPhone X, and that's because it's just shinier, you know. It's a bit more expensive, it's a bit different, it doesn't matter really how it's different, you know. I was referencing handbags at the beginning of the show. I think the iPhone X is kind of the slightly more exclusive handbag of phones, and that aspect, I'm not just saying this to be, you know, to put it down, I think the fact that it is a little bit different, more expensive, whatever, has value as well for people like us. Because just as someone who likes handbags is not going to use that $4,000 handbag better than one that would cost a couple hundred bucks, the fact that it's new and a little bit different is going to bring us joy because we like tech. Right. So I think that is also a reason why we want that phone, regardless of whether or not it has all of that technology. I think we rationalize our desire for those things a little bit with the Face ID, which when you think of it, really, is it going to be that different from Touch ID? Would I be unhappy with Touch ID? I don't think so. It works fine. And I don't even need to look at it to unlock my phone.
Right. And that's my point. My point is that it's a seamless interface, and because it's a seamless, easy to use interface, lots of people will use it. And unfortunately, this is true of the United States. It's certainly true of Scandinavia and of Europe. Our government isn't, you know, governments don't keep up and keep the same pace with technology as technology would want, right? Because it develops faster than our laws and regulations and regulators are able to think about it. And the problem is, we don't have case law. We haven't defined who owns your face, right? So we have a technology that is going to rely on it. We have seen this go into weird directions in China already. I'll give you an example. So in China, there is facial recognition technology in use in a lot of different cities. In Shandong, if you cross the street, there are electronic billboards all over the place. And if you jaywalk, that image recognition is used to identify who you are. And then your personal details are shown as a way to publicly shame you.
Oh, my God. They dox you on a billboard.
They do. And not just that. Then
that's horrible. Incident,
right. Your face and your details and the fact that you jaywalked is then sent out over Weibo.
Oh, so, my God. The Chinese social network. Oh,
right.
My God.
So here's the deal.
I mean, it's China.
But this is my job is to use data to model out what are the implications, not to predict just like what tech is coming, but what are the second, third, fourth order implications of that tech.
Well, and there's also this, I think even in the United States, this assumption that anything that's gathered when you're in public is kind of public domain because you're walking around, you're on the streets. Now, I admit that society is starting to think about that. Is just because I'm in public, should you be able to take a picture of me, for instance?
Right. And now let me tell you how this plays out. So we haven't quite figured out the who owns your face problem. But what we do know is that people are angry for various reasons all around the world and have started suing companies like Google and Apple and Facebook.
In Germany, and they sued them about pictures of Street View, pictures of your house. We call it Blurmany now because Google's been required by the courts to blur out houses at the request of the homeowners.
Or another way, another term of art is splinternet. So one of the things, if we don't figure out, you know, again, it's we need to push the envelope forward on technology, but we also need to simultaneously think about the implications in the present because we could very well end up with a sort of multiverse of internets where in Germany, you know, that the worldwide free web suddenly, you know, must also follow geographic boundaries. And it's very possible that in the near future, in like the next 10 years, there will be a German version of the internet and a Chinese version of the internet and a United States version of the internet and a Canadian version, you know, and so forth and so on, which, yes, there are ways to get around. And yes, you could theoretically still penetrate and get different versions by using, you know, IP spoofers and stuff like that. But for the average person, what that means is the way that information moves around is different. It means the way that you theoretically, if you took your iPhone 10 into France, that maybe the face recognition technology isn't legal there.
It shuts off.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, there are some real, real important things to be thinking about while we marvel at the shiny new technology. That's all I'm saying. And it's always better to try to think through this in advance and model out what those scenarios are rather than waiting for somebody to murder somebody and now somebody wants a backdoor into the phone so they can scrape your face off, whatever it might be. And suddenly we're all making decisions under significant duress and politicians are making these decisions for us and they don't know very much about technology. And it's happening all over the world, and you know it becomes very difficult.
How about this? This article from a futurist you may know, Matt Rainin, who writes on Medium about the who owns in augmented reality? Who owns the picture of the house? Some of the augmented reality apps allow you to put graffiti, virtual graffiti, on a wall. Let's say you own a restaurant, and somebody comes along and writes, "This restaurant sucks." I guess
that's part of Facebook's plan. That's what one of the things that they announced at FA.
Yeah, they showed it. Yeah.
Right.
So is that, I mean, I guess that's not much different than a Yelp review.
There's definitely a lot of questions to be asked there, and some of them are already being asked, as you're saying, Amy. And the splintered internet is already happening.
I think, thanks to the courts, the
right to be forgotten has been heavily debated, and we've all talked about it. But some links are now required to disappear from Google when you search for some things in France, and some people would like it to be unavailable worldwide because of the fact that if you go to google.com, for example, you can still access that link. So that's causing issues to a lot of people. But what you're sort of saying, Amy, if we say it a different way, is you would like the parliament to legislate on technology
I'm not saying it a different way. First of all, as far as I know, Project Selden never took off. For those of you who read Foundation, we do not
Project
have an
Project Selden. I love it.
Yeah, we don't have wit, you know.
Harry Selden. He was they were psychometricians, psychohistorians, right?
Right.
I'm going to have to think back.
So we don't have a shadow government of academics and smart, cool, geeky people running the universe, as far as I know.
Let's get that right now.
Right. So in absence of sort of one government that rules the planet, which we don't need or want, if we wind up legislating in every single different country, we're going to wind up with all of these different laws anyways. So I'm not proposing a legislative approach and that the United States and France and everybody figures out what their exact rules are. What I am saying is we are using more and more technology, and our data that we create using technology will itself become a natural resource in the very near future. And the people who use the technology don't fully understand the implications of its use. And we aren't in any way, shape, or form prepared to have a conversation legally about things like who owns your face. And this just happened in the United States during the San Bernardino shooting. There was all this back and forth about with the FBI and, you know, having a backdoor into the phone. We, you know, legislation wouldn't have solved that issue. So I'm not advocating for legislation or regulation. However, we don't have norms and standards, and there's no interoperability even at this point between countries on a lot of this stuff. So it's fine to keep working on the technology, but we can't decouple what's happening in Silicon Valley from what happens in the consumer marketplace and what happens in our respective capitals all around the world. There's got to be people working together on all of this in advance.
Let's take a break. I love this conversation. Here we are, half an hour into the show. We got real heavy already. Thank you for being here. Amy Webb, she's a futurist. I think you understand a little bit more about what that might mean. You'll find more about her at amyweb.io. Her book, The Signals Are Talking, tells you her secrets, how you can do what she does, forecast and take action on tomorrow's trends today. It's available everywhere books are. She also, of course, leads the Future Today Institute and is a speaker. Also, Patrick Beja. In fact, you had a great conversation on the Phileas Club about the era of outrage that we live in. And I wouldn't mind talking a little bit about that when we come back, because that's a great subject. Patrick is at FrenchSpin.com, where he leads his English language podcast, the Phileas Club, and his French language podcast, Le Rendez-vous Tech.
Yeah.
De les ordinateurs. My favorite word for a computer, ordinateur. You've made the transition. Last time we talked, you were working at Blizzard, but now you've made the transition. You're a full-time podcaster.
Yeah, it's happened a few years ago, you know, with the wonder of Patreon. It's been going pretty well. It's an interesting life that, you know, you've known it for a while, and I'm not as successful as you, but being a podcaster full time is kind of a strange way to live.
It's hard to explain to your mother, but at the same time, I like having control of what we do. I think there's a certain something to be said for that. Yeah,
that's certainly the great benefit of it. No
well,
boss.
Support Patrick on Patreon. What should we search for?
Le Rendez-vous Tech is the one that is my primary revenue.
Good. Good way to study French.
Exactly.
How about that, huh? And from Mashable, it's great to have Michael Nunez in the house. He is a technology editor. He's the technology editor, deputy tech editor for tech. Editor of tech for tech. I don't know what you do. At Mashable.com. Deputy tech editor at Mashable.com. How about that?
Nice. Thank you.
Our show today, you'll know about this then. If you're into tech at all, you know the words Scott E. Vest. I'm wearing Scott E. Vest underwear. I have underwear with pockets right now. I live in my Scott E. Vest jackets, shirts, pants, technology clothing designed for you. We've been fans of Scott E. Vest forever. In fact, if you get a Scott E. Vest, I think even to this day, if you get a Scott E. Vest, you'll find some pockets, inside the pockets, you'll find some cards with a picture of me wearing my Scott E. Vest. We have Twit fleeces, which we love. Those fleeces are warm, comfortable, and as with all the Scott E. Vest clothing, have strategically placed pockets. Everybody who knows tech loves Scott E. Vests. The best thing for travelers, I wear my Scott E. Vest. They actually do make vests. I think I have 26 pockets in my vest. And that means this is a great trick to get through security and to avoid weight limits. I load it up. I'll put lenses, laptops, iPads, cameras, phones, everything in my Scott E. Vest. And then when you get to the security, you just put it on the conveyor belt. That's fine. They don't mind that. You walk through. Nobody weighs your coat. It's a great way to get all your gear with you so that you never lose it. And I have to say, the zippered pockets in the Scotty vest are great for protecting your wallet. And the RFID blocking pocket is great for protecting your secret stuff, whether it's keys or cards, from snoops. Keep that passport free from high-tech skimmers, thieves. Everything Scotty Vest makes is great. Products for men and for women. Some of the pockets are fantastic. They have pockets for eyeglasses. In fact, my eyeglass pocket, I love it. It has a little, on a clip, a little eyeglass chamois to clean my glasses. I love that. The personal area network links almost all the pockets to one another, so you can keep your iPod or your iPhone in one pocket, run the headphone wires through it, have them come out at the neck. You'll never get tangled again. It is fantastic. And they don't look blocky if you load them up. I have to say, you don't look like the Pillsbury Doughboy. You're just carrying everything that you need, whether you're a photographer, a tech journalist, or you just like to have a snack in your breast pocket at all times. 21 pockets in the fleece jacket, removable sleeves, heavyweight fleece that keeps you warm. The Quest vest has 42 pockets. It's Teflon treated, so it's water and stain resistant. Did I say they have products for women too? You bet. Some really nice looking stuff for women and men. Hoodies, dresses, and skirts even that have all the famous Scotty vest features. It's the best way to travel. You see me on a plane, I will be wearing a Scotty vest. No question about it. And if you've got a geek that you've got to get a gift for, this is a great gift. The geeks don't think about this sometimes, but look at these, believe it or not, the Deborah dress, hover. I love these, the website, because if you hover over the eye, you can see where the hidden pockets are in all in these outfits. I love this. Scott, Scottevest, scottyvest.com. And we've got a deal for you. This is actually fantastic. Ditch your briefcase, your backpack, your messenger bag, your man purse. Carry it all in your fabulous Scotty vest clothing, and you get an extra 25% off right now when you go to scottyvest.com/twit. 25% off. Well, I've got some new stuff. I think I'm going to have to go and do some ordering. I like that sportsman vest. That looks good. That's sharp. I have the Tropiformer. This is what I wore in France when I was in France this year. Because I like the red piping, the styling, and look at all those pockets. I love it. ScottyVest.com/twit. Scott's a good friend, Scott Jordan. He was here just the other day with Margot, his beautiful poodle. I know he's watching. Hi, Scott. Help a fella out. Go to ScottyVest.com/twit. We'll save you 25% right now. We're having some fun here. I don't know where to go next with this. Should we go for more controversy? We were talking about the iPhone 10. I have to show you this. Apple has, in some ways become a fashion company and less of a technology company. I know every time I say this, it drives Apple fans crazy, and they say things like, yeah, well, what about the A11 Bionic chip or the amazing face recognition? Okay, fine, but if you can't get your calculator to add 1 plus 2 plus 3, what good is that? Right? Okay, maybe they're a technology company, but they are. This is, by the way, this bug, which is well-known in the iPhone, is because of looks, because of style, because of the animation. When you press the operator keys, notice the fade in and fade out. Well, the problem with that is when you're hitting numbers, if you don't pause for the fade in, fade out, they won't register properly. See, it did that right. 1 plus 2 plus 3 equals 6 if I do it slowly. But as soon as I go 1 plus 2 plus 3, 21, wait a minute, 1 plus 2 plus 3, 23, now that's, I'm not doing it super fast either. It's just a bug. And now it's an easy bug to fix. You merely interrupt the animation when the next operand is hit, but they don't seem to understand that. I don't know. They don't care. This has been around for a while. Apple's put out 3 updates to iOS 11, hasn't fixed it.
So is that really a problem, or is it something that we wouldn't notice in any other phone if it wasn't
an
iPhone?
I'll tell you why it's a problem, Patrick. First of all, you should not, at this point, you should not use the Apple calculator, period. What if I say I'm going to add up five numbers on the Apple calculator, and I do it carefully so I don't get any errors, but at one point, one place, I type it a little too fast, an error is introduced that I will not see. I will get the wrong answer.
If you're of course. I understand it.
Well, don't do your taxes with the iPhone calculator then.
It's a problem because it's a manifestation of a shift at a company that had been producing world-class, best-in-class hardware for a very long time. And I would argue that across, we can argue all day long about this, but some of the changes to the OS, some of the changes to something stupid like Keynote, you know, that for whatever reason, design is being, functionality is being sacrificed for design across a lot of the interfaces on Apple's products. And I think that's a manifestation of a organizational problem internally within the company. Stuff should look good, certainly, and we should all enjoy using it. But if the functionality suffers, then you know, eventually you wind up talking about it with Leo in front of a world enormous worldwide audience. Who wants that?
Patrick, defend
Apple.
I'm
not saying it's not happening now, but it's you know, we have selective memory. It's happened many, many, many times over the history of Apple.
Oh, yeah. Or Intel. Decades. Remember, Intel made a chip that couldn't do floating point math at all. I mean, these things happen. I understand. That's a bug which Intel patched and fixed. I have to agree with Amy. This is more... Yes, it's a bug, but it's a bug that exposes an underlying flaw in how they're thinking about what they're doing. It's not about functionality. It's not about function anymore. It's about form. It's the Johnny Ivization of technology, and I'm not sure I'm crazy about that.
Well, and this is one of the apps that's been around since the beginning. And, like, you know, I would also add that people praised Apple for referencing Braun design on this calculator. So it's something that
that's
is sort
true.
Of,
that's a good
you know,
point.
Dare I say, iconic. I've used a lot of...
you're right. It looks like a Braun... You're right. I forgot about that. Yeah.
So, but this is like one of the, I would say, most iconic apps on the iPhone because it's been around for so long and because it uses this this iconic, I guess, modern design. And so it's just a little bit weird to see a flaw or a blemish, of course, anywhere on an iPhone, but especially in something that has existed for so long that people have actually championed for a few years. So I don't know. Yeah, it's definitely unusual to see things like that. And I would say I notice more of them happening on iOS 11 than I have in years past. So, you know, ever since I've updated, my phone's been just acting really buggy.
Yeah, there are lots of cosmetic errors in 11, I think.
Yeah, exactly. There's just a lot of inconsistencies, and you know, even on the 10, there you'll see inconsistencies. You know, when you mess with that phone.
I just have to point out a calculator is the kind of thing you write in computer 101 in high school. I mean, it's not a hard thing to get right. It's just a weird thing to get wrong.
It also it's not just that they got it wrong. I mean, the part that bugs me is that was there no QA? Like, was there no usability testing before that shipped? And if not, then that's a problem. But if there was and somebody thought, well, but it looks cool, so...
Well, let's be fair. Let's go.
Come on. Honestly, do we need to go back to, like, Mobile Me and
No, this is current, Patrick. This is current.
No, but that's my point. It was they did have significant issues in their design and in their software way before this, and they were much bigger. I mean, Mobile Me was a disaster. Yeah, iTunes has bloated forever. Yeah. We're right, talking about these now as if it was new. They've always had significant issues.
Oh, okay. So your position is Apple's always sucked.
My position is that they've never been perfect. And that all of a sudden now, because, you know, but I'm not seeing, maybe we would need a scientific study on this, but I don't think I'm seeing more significant issues in the way Apple designs its software or even hardware than there were 10 years ago or 5 years ago or 20 years ago. And I, you know, we could lay out an entire list of gigantic blunders that either got fixed or they stuck to those to their guns in all of those years. So, yeah, I'm skeptical about, and maybe I've gotten used to being skeptical about, oh, now Apple's going down the drain because this or that. So maybe it's an automatic response for me, but I'm still, you know, not sure that it's worse now than it's been before.
Well, MobileMe was a big, huge, gigantic blunder. I guess what I have noticed is that the problems are more insidious. They're more sort of less of a massive catastrophe. If we put MobileMe in the massive catastrophe realm, more sort of like sprinkled throughout all their products. And it just strikes me that design is being preferenced, you know, over basic functionality. And it makes me think that is anybody, you know, Apple used to be the user-centered design, the human-centered design, you know, capital, right? It makes me wonder if humans are still at the center of their, are still the center of gravity for them. And the way
so
that
what
people
you're saying
use
is
their devices.
They're designing for the sake of design and not to make it useful
or
for users
maybe.
Anymore.
Maybe, you know, I would say that there have been design choices that certainly make the application look crisper. And I'll go back again to Keynote. The new UI on the Keynote that shipped with High Sierra certainly looks good, but it's also not intuitive in any way. And a lot of the core functionality and some of the key transitions, just basic things, either got moved or removed. And so one has to wonder, you know, why sacrifice basic usability in exchange for looks? Or, you know, was that a conscious decision? Or is Apple maybe got folks over in the design shop that just have more leverage and pull over the usability people who hopefully are testing products before they go anywhere? I don't know.
That would be a weird circumstance if the UI, if the testers said, hey, came back to the designers and said, hey, did you see this problem? And they said, yeah, that's fine. We don't
well,
mind because it looks good.
Okay,
that
so
would
then
be bad.
But what else is to explain the calculator?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, either right? They have bad QA or user interface beats QA, trumps QA. Either
right.
way, it's not good.
I'm very curious to see once the new 10 is out, you know, what interesting, like, will that be a trend that continues? Yeah. I'm curious. Yeah. I won't know because I didn't buy one.
Yeah.
But
so let's, to make it fair, Apple's not the only one having trouble with their flagship products. This is the tweet that started it all from Alex Dobie at Android Central. He showed a picture of his Pixel 2 XL after 7 days of use. And while you have to kind of look hard, there is burn-in of the back, home, and recents buttons. At the bottom, you see the dock as well burned into the screen. And I've talked to many people now. I talked to somebody yesterday who got that on his brand new Pixel 2. He took it out of the box and he saw it. Google is taking this seriously. People have contacted Google's support. The guy I talked to yesterday, Google was willing to trade in the Pixel 2 for another one and yet another one after other problems. Here's the response from Google and Mario Queiroz, who is their VP product management. And I think it was kind of I want you guys to parse this a little bit on me. First of all, there are two issues with the Pixel 2. XL. Actually, this one's the Pixel 2 as well, as color accuracy. A number of people, including I think Marquez Brownlee, have complained that the color accuracy, the Pixel seems desaturated a little bit, low quality. Google's response to that is, oh no, well, that's not a problem because you're just used to overbright displays like, say, the Samsung. And what we're doing is we're making a better looking, more accurate display. And so your eyes are conditioned to, you know, these super bright displays, you'll get used to it. This is a high quality. But then I've also seen posts from color experts who say, no, I tested this phone with color measurement hardware. It's inaccurate. So I'm thinking that some of the early, at least, Pixel 2s that came out were not calibrated at the factory as they're supposed to be. That one you can fix. That one's not
the
end of the world.
Is that something you can calibrate? Can you calibrate after the fact or no?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You can get a color profile. It's hard to calibrate it accurately without hardware. At the factory, you have the hardware. It's all automated. You put a little screen sucker on, push some buttons. It makes a profile. You put it in the software. The color will be accurate from then on. It'll be sRGB, which is what Google intends. After the fact, you're right. It's a little more tricky because you don't have that hardware. But you can. I mean, it depends on how consistent these screens are. And if they're fairly consistent, you can at least push out a more accurate color profile. That's what, by the way, most companies do. Windows doesn't have color management, but companies like Apple that do. I don't know if Apple on Mac OS has custom calibrated each display. It gives you a generic, I believe, a generic color calibration that's pretty accurate for its displays. And then, you know, if you want to go further, you can. That's less of an issue, though, than the biggest issue, this burn-in, which Google calls not burn-in, but differential aging. That's what you're seeing here on the panel, differential aging. I'm aging a lot faster than you guys are. Differential aging. Now, I understand what that means because it's an OLED screen, and so the idea is that some of the pixels are burning in because they're wearing out faster than other pixels.
But after a week?
But after a week or no time at all? That seems a little premature. Mario says, our current investigation of burn-in, which started as soon as we received the first user report on October 22nd, confirms that the differential aging is in line with that of other premium smartphones. So that's defense one. We're no worse than the other guys. Not true. And should not affect the normal day-to-day user experience of the Pixel 2 XL. Well, that's kind of subjective. I think some users might say, yeah, I don't want that. I paid a lot of money for this phone.
I think most users would probably say that they don't want that. Yeah. So this is
okay, but to be fair,
surprisingly disingenuous.
But you only see the sort of ghost marks against a solid gray screen, right?
You see it on a white screen. I think really where it would bother people is if you're watching videos and you start to see that there. I don't know. I don't have mine yet. Of course, that's the first thing I'm going to look at. The question is this a hardware flaw I guess it is a hardware flaw, but can it be fixed in software? They didn't use Samsung screens for the Pixel 2 XL. They used LG screens. Some of the complaints about the screen color and the graininess also apply to LG's V30, which uses the same panel. I've been told, I haven't verified this with Samsung, but I've been told Samsung, in its software on its OLED screens, nudges the always-on screen controls a pixel left and right periodically to jitters them a little bit to keep them from burning in. That's perhaps something Google could do. Google's response to this was to double their warranty to 2 years from 1 year. But if they can't fix the phone, that's not much good either. They say that they say that they're going to, I guess, maybe fix this somehow with software. Or it says, we use software to safeguard the user experience and maximize the life of the OLED display, and we'll make ongoing software updates to optimize further. Unknown whether they can fix this. That's going to be a big issue going forward, the Pixel 2 XL.
But the dock at the bottom is, it's not always on, right? So it functions like...
It's only on when you're on the lock screen. Yeah, it's only on when you're on the lock screen.
So, I mean, it's strange then that it would happen that the burn would happen that quickly, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I agree with the sentiment. I love my Samsung, but it is the screen is way too bright, and even at the dimmest setting, it's bright. It doesn't need to be as bright as it is.
You know that you can go in and change the screen mode, right?
I do.
They offer some different... the cinema is a considerably more muted look. But that is too...
It's pretty bright. And mostly I notice it at nighttime.
Right.
If I'm looking at it in bed right before, I go to sleep.
Do you use the night shift to turn on?
I do.
Yeah, it's still too bright.
Apple's their version of night shift is... much more, or I think it's better. It blocks a lot more of that light. It's very orange. So to that point, I think they're right. It is brighter than it needs to be, but that's weird. I don't know what would
that
cause
sells that. Phones, by the way. You know, I mean, that's the same thing with TVs. Right. You go in a showroom and see a TV. In fact, when I went to see the Pixel 2 at the Verizon store, because they have them, on display, I noted that both displays were turned up all the way because that sells the phone. And of course, the first thing you do when you get home is you Turn it down.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the Pixel 2, I want to like the Pixel phones more than I have. So this is the second year where I've just been a little disappointed with the rate of innovation on the phone. And also, okay, can you hear me?
Yeah, your video's frozen.
Oh, there we go. Okay.
That's okay.
I apologize. But yeah. The point being that, these phones have been hyped a lot, but in fact, their market share is tiny. I think they own like less than 1% of the market share in the US and probably less globally. And so, I think that it's time to start considering whether the Google Pixel is a failure or just a disappointment. But frankly, it's just like, it's not selling enough phones to compete with both Samsung and Apple.
I think they're getting started, though. I mean, that press release or that article, whatever it is very strangely worded. Honestly, it seems like my interpretation would be there are only a few of those that have been highly publicized because of, they were distributed to people in the press. That's what I'm hoping for them. And they will make it go away by replacing them, and that's going to be it, hopefully for them. But regarding their success, I think they're going very slowly at first because they're all in. You know, they're not selling it in France, for example, when they did sell the Nexus in France.
Interesting.
But they're doing all of it themselves. I think they're building teams, building relationships, and they don't want to launch it internationally or, more internationally if they don't have the proper teams, because they are now a phone selling company as well. So I think they're playing the long game here, and I wouldn't judge their performance on the first couple of years because they've never really done this themselves before. You know, they're developing chips, they're designing the phones themselves.
I think it's unfair to, as a user, to choose your phone based on sales. I mean, from a business point of view, I understand.
I have a hard time recommending the current iteration of the Pixel against something like any of the new iPhones or something like the Samsung Galaxy Note 8.
I'll tell you why I recommend it against other Android phones. Here's the Note 8. This has got the last patch on here is the August Google security patch. On a Pixel phone, it would be September, and it will soon. It'd be October, and it'll soon be November. In other words, this is 3 months behind. For security points of view, that's scary in Android land.
That's right. And Samsung also comes with a bunch of bloatware that, you don't need. I will say this. All of this sort of begs the question, because Google has another phone project called Aura. And Aura
which was dropped, by the way.
Which was dead, yeah.
I don't think it's totally dead.
The modular
You think they're still doing it?
I think they were trying to launch something in the Philippines. Like a test market, but
no. After that, they killed it. That was a failure. In September, they killed it.
You know, and from my vantage point, it was a pretty smart idea. Motorola picked up on at least part of it. So for those aren't familiar with it, Aura, it was a modular-based phone. So just like the old school computers, you would buy the sort of basic unit and then add different components to snap in and out so that you weren't having to recycle and renew your phone every couple of years, but that you could add and exchange components and upgrade the phone that way, which, again, seems like a really smart idea. So the question is, if you take a sort of, 40,000 foot view, can Google be a hardware company? And I don't have the answer to that. It certainly looks as though they are trying to firmly establish themselves as a manufacturer of stuff.
What did they spend, right? $2 billion to acquire the HTC Brain Trust?
That's a significant investment. And are they set up to be that?
Can they do it?
I don't know.
Google's faced exactly the same problem Apple's faced with, which is they have a singularly successful product. In the case of Google, it's search and advertising based on search. And they hope to have a follow-up because they know that nothing lasts forever, just like Apple with the iPhone. And that's why they've got Waymo. That's why they've got hardware. It's very hard to enter the hardware space. Look at Microsoft's challenges. Microsoft had made hardware all along, but they made their first computers, and they had all sorts of problems in the first year with the Surface. It's hard to do. You think the Ara... Now, see, I'm intrigued, because I looked at the Ara, and all I saw was, oh, that's going to be janky. It's going to be rattly and loose. And I think most end users said, I don't want to build my phone. I just want to buy it.
Well, what's funny about Ara is that the market has gone in the exact opposite direction. You know, a lot of these phones are actually harder to open up and repair and replace parts on than ever before. So, like, even the Samsungs, which, you know, famously had removable batteries for so many years.
I missed those replaceable batteries.
Yeah, exactly. Now they're completely closed systems. So, you know, in the case of Google, Samsung, Apple, and probably others that I'm forgetting, you have a phone. Oh, the Essential phone. You know, these are phones that are actually pretty difficult to open up and mess around with.
Yeah.
And so, although I loved the idea of Project Ara, because, you know, in theory it eliminates e-waste, it makes it easier to keep your same device over time. I've been sort of, you know, really amazed at how willing people have been able to just like buy a new phone every year. And now it's going to be even more interesting with them costing as much as they do, with the Galaxy Note 8 reaching up into the $1,000 price range, and then also with the iPhone 10.
That doesn't have to do with the technology only. I mean, the reason that people are habituated to buying new phones every 2 years is because when I went to buy this phone, I wanted to pay cash for it and just buy it out. And I had to jump. My carrier is AT&T. I had to jump.
Why would you ever want to do that, Amy?
But the business models are predicated on at least in the United States, throwing out perfectly good phones.
Right.
You know,
it's shocking.
Every couple of years.
It's horrible.
That's right. So the reason I would argue that the reason that a modular based system hasn't yet taken off has a lot to do also with the way that the contracts are structured and the carriers.
Oh. So it wasn't end users that didn't want it. It was the carriers that hated the idea.
Never launched. Now there is a Motorola version, similar kind of version out. That again, it hasn't taken off. Now, is the reason that it hasn't taken off because people don't understand the value of being able to upgrade different parts of the phone and customize it as it sees fit? Or because the majority of people still go into stores to purchase their equipment?
It's like, who killed the electric car?
Yeah, totally.
Consumers wanted an electric car, but GM...
That's a great analogy. Yeah, absolutely.
I guess I'm going to try and disagree with every, you know,
all three of us
you're bringing forth,
Patrick,
Amy. I think the real reason they're making really interesting, finding interesting solutions to that, you know, perceived jankiness of a modular phone. They had these super strong magnets and a bunch of things that were really clever on Project Ara. But I think the real issue is that they're solving problems that people don't want solutions to. They don't care. Yeah. We have a really great parallel with computers nowadays. You could make all of these same arguments for PCs, and no one wants a desktop where you can swap parts. Yeah. People want it's commoditized.
Yeah.
And everyone wants a laptop.
Ain't
right?
nobody That's got right. time to customize their phone.
Exactly. It's also simplified, right? It's one of the reasons why people are so attracted to the iPhone versus Android.
Yeah.
And also, if you just look at modular gadgets across the board, I mean, they've never truly caught on because consumers like things to be simple. You know, they value simplicity over essentially everything else.
Okay. let's take a little break. We want to talk about outrage. And since we did start talking about business, we should probably mention that the quarterly results were out for three of the big five. And what a surprise. They're just rolling in dough, kids. The tech industry is going great guns. And what does that all mean? We're not a business show, but I think, you know, there's something to be said, including, you know, we're going to be talking to a Scott Galloway about his book, The Four, this Friday on Triangulation. And he's the professor at your school, I think, mm-hmm. right? He's at NYU.
Sure.
Yeah. Who said that, hey, these guys better watch out because governments are going to start to crack down on them. They are monopolies. And I'm not sure I agree with him, but we can talk about, are these companies too big, too powerful? Farhad Manjoo has been talking about this. He talks about the big five, Apple, Google, Microsoft, Amazon, and Facebook, dominant in their respective fields, kind of at this point, such strong incumbents, they'd be hard to beat. I think this is an interesting topic, and it ties into those quarterly results, which are kind of confirming a little bit of that. The famous Nobel Prize winning economist Joseph Stiglitz wrote a very interesting piece in The Nation. America has a monopoly problem, and it's huge. We're dominated by large corporations in a way that has failed the many and enriched the few. Food for thought. But first, we had a fun week on Twit, and we have made a very nice little video. John, if you could roll the tape, we can watch it.
Previously on Twit.
Have you ever used the calculator in iOS 11? And then you got to do this kind of quickly.
Okay.
1 plus 2 plus 3 equals 23.
My goodness. Okay, well, if you want to pay over $1,000 for a calculator that doesn't work, you can do so.
Know-how.
The headset that he's using, again, we took a look at it last week. It's the Acer AH-101, the Windows Mixed Reality headset. It's the same price as the Oculus Rift. I would argue that it's far better. I can actually use this to help me when I'm doing my 3D designs. I can actually visualize a design in 3D space rather than having to flip the screen back and forth all the time. But, of course, for Jason, it's all super hot.
That's pretty much all that I ever want to do.
The new screensavers.
Speaking of Amazon devices, the look is here. Wow. This will let you compare two outfits, and they'll tell you which outfit is better. It's to replace friends, I guess, and family. Oh, well, let's see my results.
Oh, it had it in there.
It says, wear the suit. The combination of pieces is more flattering.
Twit. Technology isn't always pretty, but we are.
Oh, I mean, there we go. This is what it would feel like to be inside of a John Woo film, where everything's totally in slow motion.
It just makes me want to flow up.
See, okay.
You just wanted that. You wanted the super hot.
What can I say?
A lot of fun. Tune in, of course, Monday through Sunday. We're here all week long at twit.tv. You can watch live at twit.tv live or download shows from our respective shows right from the website or subscribe. Search for Twit in your favorite podcast program, and you'll find a lot of great content. Our show today brought to you by Jamf, J-A-M-F. If anybody who runs a shop with a lot of Macs probably knows about Jamf, and their new solution, Jamf Now. It's an on-demand mobile device management solution for iPhones, iPads. When we had this problem when you first start a business and you're giving your employees phones or tablets or computers, it's easy enough to keep track of them. But as you grow and you buy more tech, and it's harder to keep track of everyone's Mac and iPhone and iPad devices. Just the other day, John came up with an iPad. We had no idea whose it was, or more importantly, how to unlock it. Have we unlocked that? It's a nice iPad. We don't know. Darn it. I wish we'd been using Jamf Now. Jamf Now lets you secure a lost iPad. It makes management tasks like deploying Wi-Fi passwords easier. I am constantly asking Russell, what's the Wi-Fi password? Constantly. He could just push it out to my device. Secure company data. Enforce passcodes. It's very simple. It's very affordable. In fact, you can set up your free Jamf Now account and manage your first three devices free forever at jamf.com/twit. Just adding more devices, just $2 a month. It's easy. Remotely configure settings like passwords, email, account information. So when you deliver a computer or a tablet or a phone to your employees, it's all ready to go. You can protect sensitive information. You can even lock or wipe a device. You can centrally deploy apps, view device details. You'll get a 360-degree view of your inventory. And the nice thing about this is you don't have to be an IT expert. You don't need a Russell. Anybody can do this. Set up, manage, and protect your Apple devices in minutes so you can focus on your business instead. It's Jamf, J-A-M-F. They've been around for a long time. They're kind of the kings of managing Apple workplaces. And if you go to jamf.com/twit, You can create your free Jamf Now account and manage your first three devices, as I said, free. $2 a month per additional device. Jamf, JAMF.com/twit. Patrick Beja of the Phileas Club is here. So nice to see our favorite Frenchman. Actually, if I say that, Cédric Ingrand is going to be mad at me. And I can call you our favorite.
I'll calm him down.
Our favorite. It's funny. I was in France last month, and everywhere I went with Foursquare, Cédric had created the place.
He tends to do that.
You noticed that? Now, when I go places in Petaluma, I created them. You know, they'll say, you created this spot 8 years ago on Foursquare, and thousands of people have logged in ever since. Does anybody still use that, Foursquare and Swarm?
Don't think so.
Yeah. Kind of a shame.
Not me.
Yeah. Did you see my Amazon look? This is silly. This is the silliest thing ever, but it finally came. First of all, it's smaller than I thought. It's an Amazon Echo with a camera and a flash attached to it. And it doesn't have much of a speaker. It's like such a small speaker, you can't really hear what it's saying. That's not its point. But what you do with it, you have to have a separate app called the Look app. And the idea, and I'm going to do this, I think, is every day you get in front and you say, Echo, take my picture. And it goes boop, 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 and then it flashes. And then it takes your picture, puts the date, the weather. And then it has this style check thing here. So you could take, this is what I'm wearing today, and you could take an outfit that you wore the other day. This is not good for guys like me. And I could say, which outfit looks better? And then it checks it. It's unclear. I think when Amazon first announced the look, they said that the way it did it was they would, so now they're going to notify me when the results are ready. They would send this to a stylist, because it doesn't happen right away, and there would be a combination of computer intelligence and a stylist rating your outfits, and then it's told me which outfits I should wear. You know, for instance, for some reason unknown, it recommends the frumpy sweater vest look over the stylish suit jacket look. Okay, fine. Yesterday, I think this was correct. It recommended the Hawaiian shirt minus the Hawaiian shirt plus overcoat. I don't know. But I'm going to do this every day from now on, because at least I'll have a record of what I wore. You know, if you're on TV, it's
how long does it take to make the recommendation? Can you use it in the morning before you go to work?
Oh yeah, yeah. In fact, it'll have. See, I just got my recommendation. Okay. And it does say 70%. By the way, it weights it. So 70% stronger for my current look than the jacket. And then it tells you what's working. These colors look better together. Amy,
is this AI?
And I think there's some humans.
That's what I understood. So do they have like an army of stylists?
It's pretty fast. They're waiting.
Computers.
This was an invite only.
Probably.
Yeah, this was an invite only, and I just noticed that it was available, so I ordered it. Amy, why is Amazon doing this?
Well, so let's think about why Amazon is doing this within the broader picture of these other companies we've been talking about that are in the hardware business. So Amazon is a platform, right? Amazon, however, is a platform that's gotten itself into the hardware business and is in the hardware business in a very broad way. So Amazon's also making sensors. And they are helping.
I didn't know that.
Or I don't know if they're physically manufacturing them, but they have a program now where they're helping mining mining companies optimize their routes so that trucks can, you know, get more per gallon of mileage.
That's the part of Amazon that's the logistics company, right? That they're right, experts in logistics.
Right, and it involves hardware. And the reason I think this is so interesting is because the next era of computing, it will be powered and sort of predicated on artificial intelligence. And what's so interesting about that, within the context of what we were just talking about, those big companies, you know, are there monopolies? Are the big tech companies monopolies? And if you haven't been looking at Farhad's really, really good columns about this in the Times, you absolutely should, because he's making some really compelling and interesting arguments. But there's also a monopoly in the AI space that we just don't sort of think about. And there's 9 big companies that control the fate and future of artificial intelligence. And they include Amazon, Google, Microsoft, Facebook, Apple, IBM, and then I'm forgetting somebody. And then 3 companies in China, Tencent, Alibaba, and Baidu. And the, you know, most of those companies are also getting them, Google, sorry, I didn't mention Google. But by necessity, almost, they're also getting into the hardware space. So, you know, is Amazon trying to be the style mecca of the future? No, you know, probably not. Are they trying to use our data in an interesting way so that we use the platform more, you know, and ultimately we spend more money on their various services? Yes, right? So a lot of the hardware that I think Amazon is producing is just a different way to connect us to their platform and services where we'll spend money, which is a really interesting way of thinking about the work that they're doing and how it connects to AI and sort of the motivation behind it.
So that's interesting, because you're not fearing the data mining aspect of what they're doing so much.
Well, I mean, yeah, we should all be fearing the, we should all be thinking a lot more about what of our data is being mined and refined. And
because anybody who puts this in their closet, this Amazon look, is basically sending all their everything they that you could possibly know about my wardrobe to Amazon, who sells clothes.
Right. Now, why are we concerned about that? So I think if you ask the average person whether or not if they even knew, half of them don't know. But if the average person is concerned, it's most likely because they think somebody is sitting at a desk at Amazon,
snooping,
like watching them.
Right.
Right.
The anthropomorphize it.
And that's exactly
and I'm
right.
I'm always at great pains to say, no, Google's not reading your email. There's nobody at Google going, let's see what Leo's saying these days. It's all all machinery.
But Google is reading our email. Right. It's just not a
mechanically.
Right.
They're scanning it. It's the same exact scanning that any company does for spam keywords,
sure.
Except that instead of looking for spam, they're looking for advertising opportunities. And that doesn't bother me that much.
Well, it doesn't bother you because
it would bother me if Google, and I don't think they're doing this. I know they're not doing this. It would bother me if Google or any company was gathering information about me, let's say about my eating habits so that they could sell it to an insurance company considering offering me life insurance. That would bother me, but I don't think that's happening. In fact, I don't think there's any reason for insurance companies to do that.
No, but there are certainly reasons for, but that will be happening within the driving realm, right?
Ah.
So, right, and
yes, because Tesla knows everything that I do in my Tesla. When I brake, how fast I go. They are very openly collecting that data. In fact, so much to the point that when we called them to say, hey, this car is driving funny, I put it in reverse, but it went forward. They said, well, let me check. No.
Right.
You put it in reverse, it went backward. They know. Sure. And they don't hide it.
There's a really interesting discussion that happened a few months ago. I think it's gone away a little bit now in France, where, by the way, we have an acronym for the big 5. We call them the GAFAM. So Google, Amazon, Facebook, Apple, and Microsoft. They have their they have a name.
Yeah. Farhad calls them the frightful 5.
Right.
That works too.
Include the other ones because they're also important.
In the U.S., we think about these 5, but they're these Chinese companies as well, and Asian companies.
I mean, the reason we think about them so much is that they're really big and extra national for us. And they also don't pay a lot of taxes in France. So bringing it back to what you were saying earlier, Amy, that personal data is a natural resource now. There was a conversation about taxing those companies not on the work that they do,
right,
or on the money that they earn, but on the data that they use, considering the data on French citizens a national resource that they are mining and using, and taxing them accordingly. It didn't go anywhere so far, but it was being discussed.
One of Farhad's points is, for instance, if you're a startup, forget about it. This is one of his first articles on the Frightful Five, how Frightful Five puts startups in a lose-lose situation. And, of course, this is the power of monopoly. You don't have to have an actual monopoly. I don't think any of these companies have an actual monopoly. except maybe perhaps Facebook and social media. But then there's always Twitter and other stuff. So no, none of them have an actual monopoly, but they have enough control and power. They're big enough that it becomes a real problem to compete with them. And maybe that's why we see so few interesting new startups these days. They're all crap.
And it's even worse. It's going to get worse. There was an article by John Evans on TechCrunch a few days ago about the fact that the future technologies like AI and self-driving cars and AR and all of those require capital and data. And that is something that is a lot less available to smaller structures. So the Frightful Five are going to be basically have a stranglehold on the future technologies as well. So that's definitely a concern.
Changing. So here's again, like people don't know a lot about this, but China is the largest foreign direct investor in American technology companies, and China has invested huge sums of money into startups as well.
Through venture capital funds or how? Direct investment? Purchases?
Private equity?
Private equity.
Through direct investment. And, you know, China historically doesn't play fair. So one of the ways, you know, they're not just investing because they're hoping for a 10x return. They're investing with stipulations that IP is shared because China has put part of its sovereign wealth fund. I mean, China is going all in.
When a nation state invests in you, they don't have the same goals as an individual investor would have.
That's right. And at the moment, we aren't quite sure whether or not and how China's industrial policies now may or may not affect treaties and economic agreements because it's very complicated.
I welcome our new Chinese overlords. I don't think... Is it nefarious? Do you think we should be afraid of this?
Well, remember that story about the guy jaywalking, having his private information plastered all over the billboards?
That's fixable. Right. Maybe. Just say so that's
you
not.
You and your Hawaiian shirt broadcast all over what?
Well, I bet it stops jaywalkers.
But
sure
I mean,
it does. I think that's a cultural difference. And I don't think that necessarily means that would happen. In other countries, even if there were heavy Chinese influence, because that's a cultural difference.
It doesn't necessarily, but what it does signal is
China very much has that kind of culture of a community over individual, right?
That's right. That's right. However, and I lived in China for a while, too. So that's actually, it sounds very strange to us in the United States, but it's not out of the ordinary in China. But my point is that, you know, for people who care about America continuing to be one of the, if not the global economic superpower, you know, that could look very different as few as, you know, 15 years from now, 10, 15, 20 years.
Look, the American century is over.
Failed?
Yeah, the American century is over. We haven't noticed it yet. Right? Look at...
I don't know if I would put it like that. But
look at renewables. Look at renewables. Like, you know, what we talk about in America is how bad the air is in Beijing. But really what's going on is China is becoming the king of renewable energy, right? Mm-hmm. And that's going to be a huge advantage to them because solar is cheap compared to petroleum.
And they also, you know, we have government officials right now who are AI deniers.
Yes.
They are climate deniers.
Our Secretary of Treasury says, automation stealing jobs isn't even on our radar, he says.
Right. What? So, you know, there's a strategic advantage in China just because their elected officials don't let their personal politics get in the way of, you know, established facts, you know, scientific basis.
We're good at that. Yeah. We're very good at that. All right. So this week, Amazon, Alphabet, Microsoft all announced spectacular earnings. They beat the street, the expectations that the analysts had. That meant their stock went up. In fact, it made Jeff Bezos the richest man in the world again, yet again. He gained $10 billion in his personal net worth. He's now almost $94 billion, $4 billion more than Bill Gates. But that's not the story, really. The story is that these companies combined are worth $2 trillion. They are incredibly powerful, incredibly successful. Might as well add Intel, which beat the street as well. Actually, that's kind of surprising since I don't think Intel is a big up and comer, but Amazon, total revenue $43 billion in 3 months. Amazon Web Service, a $4 billion business per quarter. Alphabet, revenue boosted by a surge of clicks on Google Ads around the world, particularly in Asia. Microsoft beat estimates by a significant amount, by about 12 cents a share. These companies are getting bigger all the time. And I think Farhad, I have mixed feelings about Farhad's Frightful Five point of view, because it sounds a little bit like techno panic. We certainly get a lot of benefits from these companies, Amazon, Facebook, Intel, not Intel, Microsoft, Intel. Why is Intel even in there? Throw Intel out. Microsoft, Google, and the Chinese companies you mentioned. We get some significant technological benefits from them. Should we be afraid? I don't know. I'm not sure. I don't know. What do you, Michael? What do you think? You're on the ground. You're covering this stuff.
Well, I mean, it's complicated. I think that the reason why I got into technology journalism was because 10 to 15 years ago, this stuff looked really exciting. When MySpace was still around and social media was still in its infancy. Web 2.0 was sort of a new thing.
God, that sounds like 100 years ago.
That sounds like 100 years ago.
The era of Stranger Things, you know?
Well, now we're in the twilight zone. Essentially, these companies that were really young and exciting and were introducing all of these new ideas and new ways of thinking into our daily lives ended up growing so big that they have this inordinate amount of influence and this inordinate amount of power. I think to Amy's point, there has to be some element of regulation in lockstep with the growth of these companies and with the growth of this technology. The problem is that right now in government, we're just like antitrust is just like not even a it's not a concept that I don't think anyone thinks about ever at this point. There's so many other fires to put out that
I like how Sprint said, oh, this might be a good time to merge with T-Mobile, nobody's looking. Quick.
Yeah, and I think there's very little corporate oversight at this point. And so these companies that were already gigantic are growing even bigger, and I don't think people realize how bad things could be in the near future. I mean, something as simple as like net neutrality, you brought up this, this merger. That's a huge deal and it could actually cost consumers a lot. And there are so many different, nodes to attack, as a smart consumer and as like an active citizen. There are so many battles that we need to fight when it comes to the relationship between government and technology that it gets hard to sort of pick any one, right? We can talk about net neutrality, we can talk about privacy issues, whether the government should be able to snoop through your text messages or not. There are so many layers to what's going on right now, and I think what I'm seeing is that the technology is rapidly outpacing the government's ability to regulate any of this stuff. And so, I guess you just kind of have to do what you want with that information. But there seems to be no end in sight with especially these big tech companies. They're posting record profits and record revenues on what seems to be like a regular basis. And these companies have made several billionaires and several millionaires. So I just don't see an end in sight, to be totally honest.
I mean, there's certainly a concern, and I think they should be people shouldn't take their eyes off of them. But the reality is they're all more or less competing with one another. So while they are gigantic, there is an element of competition, and I'm very concerned about them. Don't get me wrong. I don't want to make excuses, but I think it's less of an immediate concern than maybe something to make sure you don't take your eye off in the next, close time, like 1-3 years. But if you want to talk about tech monopoly issues, I think the real problem you guys have in the US is what you were referring to, ISPs. That is a horrible monopoly abuse. And it's having very real consequences because you don't have the infrastructure outside of some cities, not even all cities. You don't have the infrastructure that you need in order to get the whole country to benefit from it's not even to benefit from the internet. If you don't have decent internet connection, then you're town, region, countryside, whatever, is not going to develop today. It's just not going to happen. And the stranglehold that your ISPs have on the infrastructure is damaging the country. If you want to talk about monopolies in tech, that's where people should be looking at.
Really good point. That is a mess. And in fact, we're seeing very increased aggression from the big ISPs, the Comcast, AT&T, and Verizon, against municipal Wi-Fi. They're actively suing. They're pursuing legislative agendas to keep cities from creating their own Wi-Fi in areas where they're not well served. It is a very aggressive.
That is outrageous.
Yes.
And I have in Finland here an example of the government is actually subsidizing to an extent the development of municipal communal associative ISP development. And so we have one village where my wife's family has their house that dug fiber from like 20 kilometers away, maybe even more, to the next town over. And that got a tiny village connected against the better efforts of the incumbent ISPs.
Oh,
but because the government was supporting them, they managed to do it. And now you have fiber in the middle of nowhere. And people, if they wish to do that, they can go and work from those tiny villages that are dying in all over the world. And if you don't have that, it's not going to happen. Who is going to go work in any small town that doesn't have fiber today?
Well, and then to kind of bring it back to the earlier conversation, then you see a company like Facebook propose something like internet.org, which brings an internet to developing nations, to underserved communities, but it's a special kind of internet. It's Facebook's internet. And it isn't the free and open internet. Talk about the splintering of the internet. Yeah. Ben Thompson, always astute, writes in Stratechery about Facebook in this regard. They are, of course, acquiring now a very popular, I never heard of it, but it's a student social network called TBH, which, of course, is the acronym for To Be Honest. It's a polling system that students use, 5 million downloads, 2.5 million daily active users. Ben says the FTC needs to step in and not let Facebook acquire it. He says they should have stepped in when Facebook tried to acquire WhatsApp and Instagram, because essentially Facebook's strategy is the minute any social network threatens Facebook, acquire it. Like they weren't able to copy it. If they can't acquire it, they tried to acquire Snapchat and couldn't. So they made sure Instagram was a Snapchat clone. And in fact, Instagram seems to have stolen some of Snapchat's thunder, at least with an older audience. He says this is a failure of the federal government to block this kind of thing. But maybe because he's based in Taiwan, but I don't know if he understands how unlikely it is, at least under the current regime, that we're going to see any intervention at all in this kind of thing. Certainly not an acquisition of a small company like TBH.
It isn't just the current regime. So I think one of the great failings of our various government agencies is that we don't have enough. In a lot of ways, first of all, nobody is planning out far in advance. There's no substantive data-driven long-term planning. In part, that's because we got Newt Gingrich in the 90s defunded the agency that was responsible for doing that. It was called the Office of Technology Assessment.
This was such a brilliant thing that was really helping people, the legislators, understand technology.
Right. It was nonpartisan. It became the gold standard around the world, and all kinds of countries everywhere else have that office modeled off of ours. So what we're left with is you know, a group of rotating commissioners who are political appointees, and the USPTO, the Patent and Trademark Office. And unfortunately, a lot of the future of our technology now is being decided by the whoever happens to be the commissioner du jour in those offices, who don't have, I think, enough. There aren't enough restrictions on what the how quickly those people can go back and work in the private sector, and the lobbying that they can do after the fact or before the fact. So then there's kind of a revolving door, you know. And I will say this: I am a capitalist. I believe everybody should make money. I believe everybody should have the ability to make money. But I also think that the interests of Silicon Valley butt up against necessarily, because they are commercial entities, that they rub up against the long-term interests of, you know, democracy in a lot of ways.
Society. Better to say society, the people. And the problem with capitalism is it's a good system, but sometimes the needs of society are not well served by a pure market.
And it's fine. It's not a value economy. Judgment. It's just like Google, you know, they are companies that are publicly traded, right? So they have different interests than the FTC and the FCC.
Absolutely. They're profit-focused.
That's right. And those two agencies don't have enough sort of long-term, you know, they are looking at, like they are not, first of all, they don't quite get what a lot of these companies do. And they don't really have the nonpartisan people who are there who can help them make informed decisions. And ultimately, the commissioners come and go, and they come and go back to the private sector where there are commercial interests in play. So
here's one of the things.
Contrarian for a sec.
Sure, Patrick, go ahead.
Just to be a contrarian for just a second, and I'm let's put it like that. I'm a socialist. I come from a socialist country, not in the term, in the sense that you understand socialism. But you know, France is certainly on the left end of the political spectrum. If you want to look at the world, the Western world. But even with everything you're describing, which I agree is very concerning, the reality is that the tech sector in America has not only outperformed every other tech sector in the world, but basically driven the world very successfully into beneficial revolutions in those areas. And they're all American, mostly American, and all in the Silicon Valley. There, I feel like I need to say it because it seems like it can't be a random chance, right? That system has spawned those giants that were so successful, and that we...
That was the premise really at the beginning of the conversation, is we get great benefits from Silicon Valley. But maybe it's time for some judicious intervention. Just for instance, one of the things Ben says, if the FTC wanted to, and they won't do this, but it would be great if they made a condition on the acquisition of TBH that Facebook be open up the social graph. So one of the things, you know, that is the case is that all social networks kind of lock in your friend list. You can't export your friend list from Facebook to another network. Instagram launched off the back of Twitter. Many of networks launched off the back of Twitter. But of course, the minute Facebook acquired it, it shut that down. All social networks have long since made social graph portability impossible, he writes, making it much more difficult for competitors to arise. There are things, there are tweaks, I think you'd agree, Patrick, that government could make, not to disassemble these giant companies. I don't think that's proper either, but to make them a little more societally aware in the face of profits. Hey, let's
there
take...
Hold
that thought, Amy. Yeah. I want to take a break because we're behind. And I know this is such a good conversation. It's such a great panel. I want to keep going. Amy Webb is here, futurist from a Future Institute, Future Today Institute, also the author of The Signals Are Talking, Patrick Beja from the Phileas Club, and Le Rendezvous Tech, and from Mashable, deputy tech editor, Michael Nunez. We're talking today about backup, Carbonite backup. You've heard the name before. I've talked about Carbonite for more than a decade. I've used Carbonite for that long for home or office. But I want you to take a look at the new Carbonite website, because it's a new Carbonite. They have really evolved into so much more than just a backup, an online cloud backup service. They are really the data protection experts. And you'll see that in the new website. You'll see that they've expanded. They've acquired companies like DoubleTake and eVault to give you more high availability options to create a data platform, a data protection platform that supports all of your business. For instance, keeping you from being locked in any particular cloud, making it easy to move your data around. Solutions for high availability. When in a business where downtime is not an option, you can get back in seconds. Endpoint backup, migration, server backup. It's all there at Carbonite. There's a plan for you, whether it's just a single per computer in your home or your big servers and your data center. They can, yes, data center backup and disaster recovery. They do it all. I want to encourage you to visit Carbonite. If you want to try the individual solutions, just make sure you use the offer code TWIT to get 2 months free if you decide to buy. And if you're running a big enterprise or a medium or small enterprise and you can't afford to lose that very important data that runs your business, if you want complete protection, all kinds of solutions, including disaster recovery as a service, I want you to rethink Carbonite. Carbonite.com. They've got the solutions for you, including their hybrid backup solutions powered by eVault. I love them. Carbonite.com. And if you do want to do the free trial, use the offer code TWIT just to let them know you heard about it here. You got to back it up to get it back. Do it right with the data protection specialists, Carbonite.com. Amy Webb, you started. I hope you didn't forget what we were talking about. I didn't want, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I just want to get that in. Go ahead.
Okay. So here's my thought on this.
Yes.
And what we were talking about. Do you need to recap what we were talking about or just jump in?
Well, we're talking about the fact that these frightful five, and maybe it's eight if you include some Chinese companies, are so dominant. They certainly, and I think we agree, have given us a huge benefit. We have, as Patrick pointed out, the innovation that came out of Silicon Valley has powered not just American innovation, but the world. And my suggestion is, that's fine. I don't want to ignore that. I don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater. We need these companies, but we also, it's appropriate, I think, for judicious governmental regulation to make sure it's an even, fair playing field and innovation can continue. That's where we left it off.
So here's my thought. As with any technology, the easier it is for us to use something, the closer that it resembles magic, the sort of less we think about it.
Right.
And that, and that's, what Arthur C. Clarke would say is the point, right? If the technology is like magic because it works well and we don't even have to think about it, then that's great. And we're going to use it.
Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic.
Right. However, I'm defining we very broadly here, but I think we all need to spend a little bit more time thinking about how that magic trick works. How do they do the magic? Which is not to say that we all need to go learn how to make a deep neural network or something like that, but this sort of delta is widening between us consumers and us givers of our data, and the companies that ultimately mine, harvest and refine it and use it. And as a result of that, I just wonder that this analogy doesn't quite fit, but almost in the same way that we establish national parks is a way to preserve land, I'm wondering if there's like a national park solution for our data. Like, is there a way for me to somehow either retain all ownership and rights of my data? So if I'm using somebody else's platform, I still own, and I know that you can download your data afterwards, but that's not the same. Downloading it is not the same thing as owning it, right? Because I don't get to see how Russian botnets or something looked at my data when they were on Facebook, right? So I'm just wondering, is there a way for me to have sort of portable ownership ability or some control over my data? Or if not, you know, maybe there's some kind of governance structure where everybody who's putting data into the system has some say in how that data is being used. Now, you could argue that that could completely slow down innovation. It's too complicated. You know, there's all kinds of arguments against it. But there is no denying that we are getting further and further away from the sort of core of how our technology works. And that's important because the more that we press forward with AI, and as we move from ANI, artificial narrow intelligence, to artificial general intelligence, and all of the technologies and everything else that go along with it, one of the challenges is, you know, to me, it's concerning because we have fewer and fewer people making decisions about what the future of our technology looks like. The corpus, like the data sets that are being used, the algorithms that are used that use that data, and it's like we're sort of getting further and further removed. So the national park illustration doesn't quite fit, but it's in that vein. I'm just wondering if there's a way for us to truly own our data. And if not, then let's all give up our data, but get something more meaningful in return, aside from the ability to put a stupid avatar on our Snapchat whatever's for these 5 minutes before something else comes along.
The new data protection law, the GDPR that is being planned, is about to, what is it? Is that it? GDPR? Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that something along the lines of what you're thinking?
So
tell me about that, Patrick, because you're there.
Exactly. Basically, it is it's forcefully making every company care about privacy and data and protecting it.
Does it give us our data back? Does it give us control of it, or
not so much? It restricts the use of data that I know of. I'm not an expert.
So that's problematic because I think I agree with what Amy wants, which is we need to be able to have somehow control it.
So, I mean, you control it in the sense that you consent to its uses more and you have more trust in the fact that it is better protected. But the irony of this, and I can't find the article, but it was really interesting. Basically, the irony is that it further entrenches companies like Facebook and Google that already have all of the data and the social graphs and all of those, because those are much more difficult to be shared now. So it's really hard for another company to come up with those, social graphs and clever uses of our data, because they can't acquire them as easily. And so this basically, starting with a good intention, might end up furthering the power of those huge companies.
Interesting.
So I don't know.
It requires just a couple of the bullet points, the highlights. It requires consent for data, explicit consent for data collected, and information about how it will be used. Protects children. There will be a data protection officer who will monitor this. The GDPR requires something called pseudonymization, which is basically anonymizing data. Encryption is an example of pseudonymization. Data breach notifications are required. That's something we don't have in the U.S. We sure ought to have. There are some the right to be forgotten is incorporated in it as well, although it's a limited right to erasure, which isn't, I guess, quite as sweeping. Data portability, just like we were talking about, you should be able to transfer your personal data from one system to another without being prevented from doing so. Data, I like this, data protection by design and by default. You know, so much in the U.S., we get things like Equifax, who decides to protect your data after it's already been released to the wild. All of these things seem like good things, and yet I think there's considerable concern, certainly in the United States, among these big corporations about GDPR and how to implement it, and whether it's going to be burdensome,
of course it'll be burdensome. But the burden
that's
is
the whole
on
point.
Us.
Yeah,
right.
That's the whole
I mean,
point. It should be
thing,
burdensome.
Like, but it should. But we also need to be okay being burdened. I guess that's my point. So I have a Tesla, and I love the fact that the Tesla can whatever auto park works, and you know, self like the pilot function works. And I don't know exactly how every single component of the car works, but I'm very invested in learning every single thing that I can about every single update, which is different than me just getting in the car and turning on autopilot and going somewhere. Now, I'm a different kind of person because I work with technology for a living.
What do you mean? You mean like you read before you update? You read all the things it's going to do? Or you read terms of... You do, really?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the updates get pushed, so it's not like... It's hard
to
sort of...
Yeah, you have to do it sort of after the fact, yeah. I got pushed an update that broke my garage door opener. I'm not real happy about that. I called them, and it's a widespread problem, and they haven't fixed it yet. I asked the guy, I said, yeah, we've just started pushing out the fix, but we do it in bunches, so you won't have it for a while.
You know, it's funny. You're both exemplifying why we need the governments to be involved in this. And I understand I'm talking to a mostly American audience and going against what I was sort of implying by, again, being a contrarian earlier.
Yes.
But this is the only way these things work. If you don't have the government, which, by the way, is by design, this is not going to be popular in the U.S., but it is representing the common interest of the people.
That's what it's supposed
as
to.
As opposed to private companies. Yeah. Yeah.
Here in the U.S., it might work the other way.
The government.
Yeah. I agree with you. Amazon, here's a good one. What do you think about this? Amazon wants to offer a service that lets the delivery person inside your house... Because here's the problem in the United States. Packages get stolen off of porches all the time. It's a big problem. So it's only currently available in areas where Amazon does the delivery. They're not going to let the UPS or FedEx or the Postal Service driver in your house. And you have to spend $250 on a special door lock and the cloud cam, a special camera, because they want a camera watching the guy or gal as they make the delivery. But if you're willing to spend that $250, then you don't have to worry about packages on your doorstep anymore. They're just going to let you right in.
Why not, if you have a house anyway, why not put a giant post box?
Put a box in front of it.
Like, not post box. Put a box.
With an Amazon key.
Well, that's a good question. That's a very good question. Why wouldn't Amazon just do that? And I have a thought on that, which is it goes back to data. So, you know,
there are other ways to solve it, but what Amazon's most interested in is getting a camera in your house.
And collecting, I don't think surveilling every single thing that we're doing, but Amazon is this, you know, absolutely one of the smartest companies that we track when it comes to understand, you know, very, very clever use of data, like very clever use of data. You know, this whole thing with the trucks that I mentioned and coal, I don't think that Amazon is trying to get into the logistics business specifically to help coal miners. Isn't it more possible or probable that Amazon assumes that, or it's trying to build itself into the company that will sort of be the cloud for all of the various connected car companies? Yeah. All of these car manufacturers, you know, have promised self-driving fleets, but Ford doesn't have its own, you know, cloud server where it's able, it's able to process all.
If you don't have the data and you don't have a way to gather it, you're out of luck.
That's right. So isn't it possible? So every time Amazon launches something new, in the back of my mind, you know, I treat all of these product launches as weak signals, and weak signals are what futurists use to sort of spot pattern. Right.
Right.
So is this really about making it so that fewer people steal your packages?
Right.
I don't think so. No. To me, this is a weak signal. That's
same thing with a look.
Yeah.
Same thing with the look. And what we don't know, because it's not our business and we're not data scientists, is how these little bits of data, how valuable they can be. You might say, well, you know, Amazon knows when you got a delivery and whether you were home and who cares. But what I think is we just don't understand the great value of gathering this massive data has.
That's right.
And the interesting, unique ways that can be used. Amazon doesn't want to help me choose what outfit to wear. There's no percentage in that. It's clear they're up to something.
There's a marginal benefit to the company for the Amazon key thing and for the look and for all of those. But certainly the data is, I mean, it's the gold and the fuel and the petrol, you know, the next version of that. And it keeps coming back, right? For AI, which is going to, deep learning and AI, which are going to power everything, you need data. If you don't have the data, it just doesn't work.
Yeah.
And so that's something that I think we should be more aware of. You're very right, Amy, in at least in the tech industry, like tech media isn't aware enough of this, you know, the importance of data.
Look at this. I to do the Carbonite ad, I went to the Carbonite website to show the Carbonite website. And now when I read this story about Amazon Key on The Verge, I get a Carbonite ad. This is a perfect example. That wouldn't have been there 2 clicks ago. But it's a perfect example of how, and this is from Google, how Google, and I'm using the Microsoft Edge browser, but the circle is like this of data coming and going and flowing. And, you know, in this case, it's just showing me an ad of something I'm already shown and interested in. That's not a bad thing. Yet, it just shows you how free-flowing this information is. Google wasn't involved in that transaction, yet they know exactly where I went, and they are in fact putting up an ad keyed to what I went. All right, let's take one more break. We got to get one more ad in, and I have a couple of lightweight things because I don't want to end on a deep, heavy, profound note. I'd like to end on a fun note. How about that? Although this is kind of heavy, and maybe I should do this first. Roger Stone got banned from Twitter. Twitter, which announced a calendar of new rules, is apparently taking them seriously. Roger Stone, who is a very outspoken, in fact, you've got to see the documentary Get Me Roger Stone, fella, has decided over the weekend that Don Lemon at CNN was the devil incarnate in a series of vicious tweets, including saying he should be punished, have gotten his account banished. Roger Stone has been suspended. Twitter is not saying if this is permanent, but his account is suspended. Stone immediately took to tweeting from the Roger Stone documentary movie account. So there apparently is a loophole. In fact, we've known this all along. You can always create a new account. So Stone says he's hired one of the best telecommunications lawyers in the country and will sue Twitter it's not clear whether there are legal grounds to do so.
He's pretty litigious. He'll probably do it anyway.
Yeah, he sues no matter what, right?
Yeah.
He says, I've been inundated on Twitter, and this is not a bad point, with bloggers threatening to kill me, my wife, my kids, even my dogs. Twitter seems unconcerned about that. So battle rages. The battle rages. And one more story for Facebook, and we'll probably talk about this on Wednesday with Jeff Jarvis because he's our journalism guru. Facebook is apparently testing keeping publishers' articles out of the stream unless they pay for it. This is not in the U.S. yet. It's in 6 countries. They're taking publishing content from publishers and businesses out of the news feed. Those posts will exist in the Explore feed unless the publisher pays for placement in the news feed.
Right. So remember when Facebook was a place to find
publish your newspaper
from your friends, news from your friends and family and stuff like that?
And then it became a place for Washington Post and Wall Street Journal put articles. And look at the this is a tweet from somebody, but he's talking about a drop in organic reach. Pages have 4 times less interactions in countries where the feed has been modified.
Wow.
You just could see the drop, right?
So that means the people using Facebook there see more of the people
friends and family
actually know. Yeah, exactly. It doesn't, I mean, I understand the consequence, but it seems like there could be a logical explanation to this test.
Oh, I understand it. It just underscores why if you're a business or a publication, using Facebook as your way of generating traffic is probably not the best idea. Because after all, Facebook controls it.
Yeah, why would Facebook charge?
We live in a capitalist economy, and if they charge, let Amy ask this question.
Here's why. Because about a year ago, I admonished, it doesn't matter, I was speaking at a conference after writing some stuff, and I said, you know, news organizations have no longer controlled the means for distribution, so everybody should get together and decide nobody's publishing anything on Facebook, and then Facebook will just be a wasteland of friends and family posts and, you know, stuff that nobody wants to read. they were reluctant to do that. Now, I'm just anecdotally, we did a study to try to figure out how much of Facebook's UI is dependent upon quality journalism. And it turns out there's quite a bit of it.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Yeah. So what I'm trying to figure out is what net benefit is there to Facebook? I mean, obviously, they know what their leverage is right now. But news organizations are so strapped, if they forced news orgs to pay, which they can't really do, then what's their end game? Like, why? I can't figure out what do you guys think? Why would they be doing that?
Oh, they're just not going to take away the ads. That's the reason why they, you know, the way they put it in the article is basically they force you to pay in order for you to appear on people's feeds, as if that was a strategy to, encourage people to pay more. I think the strategy is to make the feeds more personal, but at the same time, they're not going to turn away the ad money. So if you pay, that would mean there's no more revenue for Facebook. So they keep the ads in there. And that's it. It's a test, but
I mean, I think that that for the past decade or a little more than that, I guess Facebook has made a lot of publications basically addicted to the Facebook newsfeed as a source of distribution, and now they're just I can't blame them for trying to collect on that addiction, right? Because this is a necessity for actually a lot of the largest publishers in the U.S., probably even in the world. And so it's really easy for Facebook to basically just flip a switch and ultimately hurt the bottom line for these companies. And so, already a lot of the biggest publishers in New York, let's say, are spending thousands of dollars on Facebook to promote certain stories and to promote certain social media campaigns on a monthly basis. I think it's safe to say. And so, I would just see this as Facebook sort of, I think that of course they're looking to charge publishers for distribution because this is one of the biggest use cases for the network right now. People are publishing less original content, and therefore Facebook's relying on publishers for a lot of that content. And one way that you can, quickly increase revenue is by making those publishers pay to have their content seen, because a lot of them already are doing a version of that, which is paying, a smaller amount to have certain stories promoted and boosted a little bit. This is it's the same model, but just applied in a different way, in my opinion.
Matthew Inman, the cartoonist at The Oatmeal, has a very trenchant point to make. He published a cartoon reaching people on the internet, how it used to be. Come on over. I've got some neat stuff here at my website. What happened? Well, Facebook. Actually, follow me over there. It'll be easier for us to reach each other where we're at now. Hey, I made some new stuff. Can you show it to my followers? Facebook's closed the door and says, boost this post. The irony is he posted that cartoon on Facebook, and then Facebook said, get more likes, comments, and shares. This post is performing better than 95% of the other posts on your page. Boost this post for $2,000 to reach up to 490,000 people.
I get those all the time.
I get them all the time, too. It's kind of ironic. I love it. Hey.
I do want to entertain the possibility that this is to address the issue of viral political
fake news. It could be.
And
it is. And it is a small test in six countries. It's not a national, international.
Yeah. But it's also important to remember that all tests begin as small tests on Facebook.
Yes.
But a small test on Facebook can actually mean tens of thousands and potentially millions of people.
Yeah. As we saw from those Slovakian websites, that they're hit hard by that.
They can just context again. Facebook can absolutely combat misinformation and fake news without charging publisher like quality journalism.
There's other ways to do it. Yeah.
Organizations, right.
Other ways to do it. Let's take a break. Final thoughts in just a moment with a great panel. Really fun today. Michael Nunez, he's deputy tech editor at Mashable, joining us from Brooklyn, New York. Amy Webb joining us from D.C., right, Amy?
Yep.
Yep. Washington, D.C. She's the author of The Signals Are Talking, a great book on futurists and how they work. She's also a futurist herself, as you probably can tell from her astute insights. And Patrick Bejar, favorite Frenchman, at least one of them, from the Phileas Club. And of course, Le Rendezvous Tech. Our show today brought to you by, appropriate for a Frenchman visiting us, wine by Blue Apron. We know Blue Apron. We talked about Blue Apron, the number one food delivery company in the country, packaging wonderful ingredients with great recipes to make a delicious dinner. But now you can expand your wine palette with Blue Apron's wine boxes. With Blue Apron, no wine leftovers because their bottles are a little bit smaller, which is nice because I always have leftover wine in a regular size bottle. Lisa and I open up a bottle of Blue Apron wine. It's delicious. It's wonderful. They curate a great collection. Great way to de-stress in the evening but not wake up with a hangover the next morning. Perfectly sized for two to share over a lovely weeknight meal, a Blue Apron meal, I hope. $10 a bottle, that's half the price of what you'd find in the store. Because, of course, they go to the source. They deliver it directly from the winery, eliminating the costs of a middleman. Six new wines monthly from all over Napa. Our favorites are Bordeaux. We've had some wonderful Bordeaux from Blue Apron. You customize the box, of course, with the styles and varieties you love. And Blue Apron includes custom tasting notes. So just as Blue Apron has taught us all how to cook great new recipes and ingredients, they're now going to make wine fun by giving you the who, the what, the where of every wine they send. I love this, and we're going to get you $25 off your first wine box by going to blueapron.com/twitwine. We've been doing this for some time. In fact, I think I remember that we convinced them that they should talk about the wine. For a long time, we were talking about the food, of course. We love our Blue Apron boxes. And Lisa said, you know, you really ought to tell people about this wine thing. It's fantastic. blueapron.com/twitwine. Perfectly sized wines with custom tasting notes, helping you to discover fabulous new flavors. blueapron.com/twitwine. As always, Blue Apron, a better way to cook, and now a better way to imbibe.
Convince them to launch in Europe.
You need this in Europe. You need this.
Yes.
I like the smaller bottles.
I know, because a full yeah. size is, it's just, it's not.
Don't laugh at me. I'm American. I can barely get through a.
It's not a split. It's perfect for two. I don't know what, it's a little bigger than the split. It's like halfway between a split, a half bottle, and a full bottle. It's like a two. Yeah. It's perfect. I wonder, now, Patrick, let me ask you, when you buy a cheeseburger in Europe, France, or Finland, where is the cheese on the cheeseburger?
We're going to talk emojis, aren't we?
We're talking emojis. It's a big deal here.
I would say the cheese is on top of the patty,
yes,
but below the lettuce.
Yeah, you
and
put the lettuce. Look, I worked at McDonald's. I know exactly how you do it. Two Albee patty, special sauce, lettuce, cheese, pickles, onions, and a sesame seed bun, going from the bottom to the top, and you put the condiments on the meat. Then you put the cheese on the meat, the condiments on top of the cheese, and then the lettuce. Anyway, for some reason, bizarrely, Google's emoji features the cheese on the bottom. Now, I know this is not the end of the world, but apparently Sundar Pichai thinks so. The CEO of Google has tweeted after Thomas Biechtel tweeted, "I think we need to have a discussion on how Google's burger emoji is placing the cheese underneath the burger while Apple puts it on the top." Sundar tweets, "We'll drop everything else we are doing and address on Monday." If,
to be fair,
folks can agree on a correct way to do this. Now, are you going to tell me it's okay to have the cheese on the bottom, Amy?
No. I feel like I read on Mashable that, like, for various reasons, you're supposed to put the cheese on the, like, we've been doing it wrong. Like, you're supposed to put the cheese for some reason on the bottom.
Okay. Okay. Well, thank goodness I have somebody from Mashable right here. Here's how McDonald's does it. Interestingly, they put the cheese on the underneath the bottom patty.
Yeah,
on the Big Mac, it's not the case on all of them.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, well, because you can't do that because then you can't melt the cheese, right? So, you know, if you're doing this properly, you're putting the cheese on top of the patty while it's on the grill, so that the cheese melts, and then you can transfer the patty and the cheese to the bun, dress it
right,
up.
But aren't you supposed to flip it and put the cheese on the? I swear I read that on Mashable.
By the way, the tweet thread in response to Sundar Pichai is awesome. Here's Facebook's cheeseburger emojis compared to Facebook Messenger's. And Kaspar Klipkin points out, hey, Dave Marcus, you need to put more sesame seeds on the Messenger bun. There's only three on the mess. But David then responds, those are poppy seeds, but our cheese is excellent. And on and on and on. Cheese always goes on top so it can melt. Sundar? Also, by the way, while you're at it, this is not how beer works. And that actually, I think it makes an excellent point. The foam is on top of the mug, but there's this air gap between the top of the beer and the foam. Google, go home. You're drunk. That's not how beer works.
This is how their deep learning algorithms told them that beer worked.
This is the funniest.
You know, they do everything with algorithms.
Yeah, it's a very interesting thread. I don't know where they might have gotten the idea that the cheese goes under the patty.
Oh, wow. That's Danny Mayer. Was that the Danny Mayer?
Who's Danny Mayer?
Oh, very, very famous New York City.
Oh, from Union Square. Yeah. Oh, founder of Shake Shack.
Yeah.
Danny, he must be a gourmet. He's got a napkin to his lips in his Twitter avatar.
His restaurants are great.
So he's got a diagram. Apparently Katie Couric got involved in this as well. This is crazy. You know what? The smaller, the less important, the less relevant the topic, the easier it is for anybody to have an opinion. And I think that's what's going on. And by the way, somebody responded to a Google image search, which seems like that should be definitive. Apparently, the person responsible for Google's new emojis is a vegetarian teetotaler, according to Damian Burns. We may never solve this conundrum, but I'll be watching with interest tomorrow to see if Google fixes this problem. Yes, it is.
I really
indeed
hope they change their emoji based on this Twitter thread. You know, it's Twitter certainly has a lot of influence in very important things in the world. It's nice that also sometimes some ridiculous thing happens and becomes a thing. You know, it seems like it happened like this all the time a few years ago, and nowadays it's only horrible horrors that happen on Twitter. I like that the emoji burger thing became a thing and everyone's jumping in on it.
Of course, you're French, where at the McDonald's, the Le Royale and the Royale with cheese have no salad. Because everyone knows in France, the salad comes after the meal, my friends, after.
And the cheese on the Royale with cheese is on top and on bottom.
It's both.
The patty, so.
Because, yes, because the French believe in more cheese.
What is all that white stuff? Is that mayonnaise?
That's le secret sauce.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Le sauce secret. I'm deadly afraid that might mean the secretion sauce in French. I don't want to go farther than that.
No, actually, McDonald's is a lot better in France than it is in the U.S.
Yes.
Surprisingly.
Some Americans may disagree. It doesn't taste the same. Let's put it that way.
Well, they could disagree, but they would be wrong.
Patrick Veja, follow him at FrenchSpin.com on the Twitter. He's not Patrick. I never got the explanation for that. Why are you
not
Patrick? You are Patrick.
A couple of things. First of all, Patrick was already taken, which is completely, you know, anecdotic in the reasoning. The real reason is that it is a brilliant marketing move. You hear
you got
it
me.
Once and you never forget it.
Not Patrick.
Yeah.
He is for the English language podcast, Phileas Club at FrenchSpin.com. But if you want to listen to the Rendezvous Tech in French, FrenchSpin.fr, of course. And he makes his home now in Helsinki. It's great to have you. Thank you for joining us. It's probably 4 in the morning.
Yeah, it's getting there. It's 2:30, but I'm soldiering on.
Thank you for staying up late with us. I really appreciate it.
A pleasure.
Amy Webb, always a pleasure. Go to amyweb.io to find out everything Amy is up to. Just the more we have you on, the more I want to have you on. You're just so great, so smart. And I love your perspective, which is a perspective that, you know, kind of the long range perspective. And we're so quotidian in our concerns that it's nice to think about the future a little bit. Her book, The Signals Is Talking, she's grammatical. The Signals Are Talking. The Signals Is Talking is another book entirely. Why Today's Fringe is Tomorrow's Mainstream. Bestseller, available everywhere. And of course, her company is on the website at amywebb.io. You could find out about her futurists and her future and tomorrow's future today. Thank you, Amy. Great to have you here. Appreciate
Thanks.
It. And my good friend, glad to have you back. Please come back anytime from Mashable, where he is the deputy tech editor, Mr. Michael Nunez. Michael, you held that microphone like a champ for 2.5 hours.
Yeah, thanks for hanging in there with me. I definitely appreciate the invitation.
We're going to send you we'll send you a headset and you don't have to hold on to from now on.
That'd be great.
Thank you all for joining us. We do This Week in Tech every Sunday afternoon. Really is fun every week to get together with just the best people and talk about what's going on, try to understand it in a deeper way than the daily headlines. You can join us around about 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern time. That's 2200 UTC, and we'll be for one more week, and then daylight saving times ends, and we'll be at 2300 UTC, but we'll talk about that next week. If you can't watch live, and by the way, if you are here live watching twit.tv/live or live stream, please join us in the chat room at irc.twit.tv. Great bunch of people in there, and the background chatter helps you. Basically, they write all my jokes. It's very, very helpful if you come and write jokes for me at irc.twit.tv. You can also be in-house. We had some great visitors from all over the world. If you want to visit, just email tickets at twit.tv so we know you're coming. We love having people from all over who listen to the show come visit us, like Toshi, who visited from Japan, Srinivas, who's from Mumbai, India, visiting today from Boston, Massachusetts, Bob, and from Boulder, Colorado, Steve. Great to have you guys here. Just email tickets at twit.tv. We'd love to have you in studio with us. If you can't watch live or be here live, you can always get on demand of all of our shows at easily enough at the website twit.tv or subscribe in your favorite podcatcher. That way you'll get every episode. It's getting to be a lot like the end of the year. I can't believe it. We're already starting to talk about the end of the year. We're putting together our best of episodes for all of our Twit shows. We would love your help. It's easy. If you remember a moment that you really, you know, that was great, whether it was thought-provoking or funny or just weird, go to twit.tv/bestof and give us whatever information you know about it. Even if you just say, hey, that time when they did that with the thing and the thing on the head, that was a great time. Even that will be helpful because our editors have to work hard to comb through 52 weeks of shows to put together the best of. We'll have that at the end of the year. I think it'll be our New Year's Day show, right? Is it New Year's Eve or New Year's Day on the last Sunday of the year? twit.tv/bestof. Thanks, everybody, for being here. It's great to see you. Come back again next week, will you? But for now, another Twit is in the can. Bye-bye.
Doing the Twit.